go. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! That we begin this 18th day of December 2014 edition of The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That's where you go if you want to jump into the chat room. Already a happy gathering of folks hopping by. Good evening, Anatole. Good evening, News Ninja Carol Baker. Good evening, Gerald. Good evening, Jeremy. And good evening to both manifestations of Sparky, both Sparky and Man Cave. And good evening to chat room moderator Lottie as well. And I'm sure more will wander by in short order if you would like to join in the festivities, the real-time, real-fun experience that is the Horn Chat Room. Well, there's good news. It's free and it's easy. Just pop on by, head on radionetwork.com, click on Chat Room, pick yourself out a screen name and a password, and away you go. Right? Right. Also at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, the Listen Live pop-out player, which works real good-like. And, of course, you will also find the immediate link to podcast archives. There, that's there, too. And then, of course, there's the ever-present and ubiquitous PayPal interface under the tab Contribute. The tab says Contribute, and that's and you hook up with PayPal that way. And I am pleased to announce that we have another challenge on the table. You know, we had a challenge two nights running, and it went unresponded to almost entirely. But this evening we have a note from Robert in Australia, who's 19th of the month here, 20th of the month up over down there. In other words, the 20th of the month up over down under challenge comes around every month and is frequently fulfilled. Robert writes, time to double down. It's almost the 20th, so I'm putting up $150 for Thursday's conversation. And if that's met, I'll be putting up $150 for Friday's conversation, too. Nuff said. How about that? That's pretty impressive. Thank you very kindly, Robert. I thank you. That's just astonishing. And by way of incentive, we have premiums. Yes, we do. For anybody who wants to jump in with a $50 premium, we have brand new, courtesy of chat room moderator Lottie, we have brand new Horn bumper stickers, one of which will come your way. We also have, at the $75 level, a Ozark Hooterville Holler gift basket put together by the one, the only, News Ninja Carol Baker. And at the $100 level, we have for you a pound of wild rice, kindly provided by my friends. A pound of wild rice, which will be yours, and which was, in fact, harvested in the time-honored heritage fashion known for thousands of years up in the pristine waters near the shores of Lake Superior in northwest Wisconsin. Thank you, one and all. If you want it, however you want it, just put a note in the PayPal box and let me know. It would be great if Robert could know in short order that his challenge has been met. And remember, this one's two-pronged. One, he doubles your money up to $150 this evening, and then two, if that happens, it's a condition precedent, then he's willing to double up to $150 tomorrow as well. And that's great, especially as we run downhill toward the end of the month and the end of December. So it is the 20th of the month, Up Over, Down Under Challenge, courtesy of Robert. Also this evening, we have a sponsorship of sorts. I had a note from Roger, who, going back to the news coming out of before the 2014 November elections, that a VAID would not be accepted in the state of Texas. Well, Roger wants to share with you the following message. Suggested interim measure on Texas and similar voter ID rules on the unacceptability of veteran ID cards as proof of voter being voter. While there aren't that many people, as a percentage of the total population, whose best or most readily accessible ID is their veteran's ID, this is a group worthy of thoughtful consideration. Whether their treatment at the VA is due to a physical wound or something less visible like PTSD, it is not grounds for the state of Texas or any other place to add them to the list of people that they think do not matter. If anything, that kind of treatment could exacerbate PTSD, and no one in the real world feels better after being told they don't matter any longer, just because they can't go and serve in a foreign war for a corporate agenda. What I propose, until such time as the dignity of the person is restored, I would like to ask active duty members of the armed forces, whose ID is considered valid in these localities, to work on restoring dignified treatment of those who served with them or before them. Please, when you attend a political function or any place that politicians will be present, do so in uniform. Ask your politicians what their position is on your state's law regarding rejecting veterans' ID for voter ID purposes. Do not tell them what they should say. Just ask them to explain on the record what their position is and leave it at that. Please do not wait like the fake opposition groups that pretend to object to laws but always show up with too little too late to make a difference until a few weeks before an election to start doing this. Begin doing it now. Not as a special endeavor, but as an adjunct to your current routine. At some point, the squeaky wheel principle, from being reminded that they supported the original bill or have failed to propose fixing the current one, should result in corrective legislation well in time for the next election cycle. Thank you for at least considering this. I believe we were all taught not to leave anyone behind. Signed, an old citizen who happens to be an ex-Marine. Sounds like a fine idea, a very fine idea. There's no reason that problem should not be solved. In addition, a further note, this came in earlier today. I just received an early holiday present of sorts and wanted to share. I believe I mentioned in the past, although maybe not because sometimes I get distracted, go on tangents, and never make it to my original point, about the postcards I was sending. Brief recap. My father's side of the family lived in Hood River, Oregon, working their farm and orchard. My father's eldest brother was already in the Army before the attack on Pearl Harbor. Another older brother signed up shortly after Pearl Harbor. Both of them were assigned to military intelligence for the Pacific because of their language skills. My father was still in high school. I guess they'd call him a fighting-age male today, So when they rounded up all the West Coast Japanese and put them in relocation centers, that's where he ended up. That is, until a couple of years later when he received his draft notice at the internment camp. He reported as ordered and was assigned to military intelligence just like his brothers for the same reason. A few years ago, they were included in the groups honored with the Congressional Gold Medal for their service during World War II. I see I've wandered away from my main point. See how that happens? Anyway, I ended up being the primary caregiver for my father, Alzheimer's. But the task came with an unexpected perk. Sometimes he would think that I was his younger brother and talk about life at camp. He would get very emotional when he spoke about a couple of the camp treasures, valued for their content as well as their rarity. These treasures were the few pieces of correspondence which were received from Americans who sympathized with them and wanted to let them know they were not forgotten. Meandering back toward today's event. After my father died in 2012, we found several boxes of unused postcards from the 50s, 60s, and 70s. That same week, someone posted a complete detainee list for the people still being held at Gitmo and another for pretrial Bradley Manning. Although I know Dad would never have jeopardized his own security clearance by sending anything to them, I also believe he would quietly approve of my taking the initiative to do so. Because I didn't know any of them, I applied the grade school gum principle, did you bring enough for everyone, and mailed one to each of them at the same time. I sent 6 sets to the Gitmo people and about 100 to PFC Manning before the Livingston Parish James T. Crow Alumni Society began working me over for being uppity and all. Approaching my point, really. When I got back last month, I was able to send another set of postcards to Gitmo and a few to Chelsea at her new address. Today's present, it sounds redundant but isn't, was that 2 of the cards came back as undeliverable. This is my first indication that my letters and cards are, in fact, being delivered. And yes, I had my doubts. Happy holidays. For those of us who aren't political prisoners. Yet. That, to say the very least, is bracing and inspiring. And so when he suggests taking quiet action such as he does with regard to VAID and voting, understand it's not coming from someone who is asking someone else to do something he himself is unwilling to do. Activism doesn't have to be a grand plan. Activism can be something as quiet as standing silently, as one of our dear friends did throughout the Iraq and Afghanistan war, standing silently in mute protest with a pair of boots and a bouquet of flowers. In silent protest of a war being waged in her name. There's always something that we all can do. And so I am grateful for the opportunity to share that message, and I will read it again later during the program. Thank you very kindly, Jeremy. Jeremy noting that we are loud and clear on TuneIn. Much appreciated. And I am happy to announce, thank you very kindly, Carol and Thomas, that we are on our way to meeting the Up Over Down Under Challenge for this 18th day of December. We have now $130 to go, and hopefully it will go quickly. This, of course, is Thorn in the Side Thursday. We reserve Thorn in the Side Thursday for right-wingery, white-wingery, that is sufficient to make one kick furniture, stomp one's own feet, generally make nonverbal barbaric noises, because that's what that sort of thing reduces us to. Yeah. And so it is, this here Thorn in the Side Thursday, that we find ourselves with a great brace, if you will, of things sufficient to induce in us such conduct. Let us hie ourselves hence to both Nebraska and Oklahoma Stan. For those states, in their not infinite, but oh, Lord Jesus, yes, truly finite, and to use the word wisdom is really not fair, their finite attempt at channeling some sort of electrical current out of the thin gray settlings that slosh around between their ears and ride over top of their amygdalas and pass for brains. Oklahoma, and the attorneys general thereof, of Oklahoma and Nebraska, have, and I'm not kidding, sued the state of Colorado. Yeah. They have. They've sued the state of Colorado in federal court. And it's not just federal court that they've sued the state of Colorado in. They have sued the state of Colorado claiming the original jurisdiction, which means that's where the case begins, claiming original jurisdiction in the Supreme Court of the United States. No pissant district courts for Colorado and Oklahoma, or Nebraska and Oklahoma Stan. Oh, no. No, they're going to ask the nine to hear this one straight up and actually try the case. Hint. I would submit that probably most of the members of the Supreme Court would be lost in a trial court. I sit where? The jury's who? Because the Supreme Court typically hears cases of an appellate nature. They are the ultimate court of appeal. And they do not base their decisions upon witness testimony adduced before them, in which they look at the witness and gauge the witness's credibility. For instance, one might imagine them going into, at least the sane ones, and that means not the rats, not Roberts, Alito, Thomas, and Scalia, or that Kennedy fellow, hearing the testimony, say, of witness 40, and not just, doing what we do on days like this and kicking furniture and stomping their own feet. But no, the attorneys general of Nebraska and Oklahoma Stan have claimed original jurisdiction in the Supreme Court of the United States to sue the state of Colorado, over the legalization of cannabis. Yes, really. They want the Supreme Court to strike down the intent of the voters of the state of Colorado in legalizing a substance which grows naturally just about through, I think it grows in all 50 states, doesn't it? You can grow it legally in Alaska, for God's sakes, for personal use. And we know it grows in Hawaii, Maui, Maui. But it grows and is sold legally in Colorado. Colorado's attorney general is John Suthers, S-U-T-H-E-R-S, And he says he thinks it might be a sometimes called a friendly suit, because he wants because Nebraska and Oklahoma want to force the federal government's hand on cannabis policy. Southers said in a press release, because neighboring states have expressed concern about Colorado-grown marijuana coming into their states, we are not entirely surprised by this action. However, it appears the plaintiff's primary grievance stems from non-enforcement of federal laws regarding marijuana as opposed to choices made by the voters of Colorado. We believe this suit is without merit, and we will vigorously defend it against it in the U.S. Supreme Court. Hoop! It is, so anybody who thought that just because some voters said, and see, there's a dynamic tension at work here. Ordinarily, you would think a bunch of right-wingers, and understand when you're talking about Oklahoma Stan, you're not talking about any raving liberals out there. You would think, because you can't turn around without some repiglick and hollering, states' rights! States' rights! I mean, hell, they're arguing nullification half the time now. Jesus God. Let's see. But right-wing states holler states' rights, but suddenly now they want the federal government to step in and defeat the will of voters in Colorado, which I guess you could make an argument that, well, you know, I mean, voters went to the polls and passed all them DOMAs too, didn't they? Those Defense of Marriage Amendments, didn't they pass those? Well, yes, they did. But those were found to be unconstitutional by the Supreme Court of the United States, based not upon the fact that the voters aren't able to do that sort of thing, but that the voters cannot go to the polls and defeat the rights of others in contravention of the 14th Amendment and the rest of the whole freaking Constitution, for that matter, no matter how many of them vote in favor of doing so. That does not obtain with the voters' will in regard to cannabis. Nobody's Fourth Amendment, nobody is being declared a second-class citizen by virtue of the fact that you can, oh, dude, wander into a store and buy some Bubba Kush, you know, in Denver or whatever. The suit papers read in part as follows. The nation's anti-drug laws reflect... There I was trying to be serious. The nation's anti-drug laws reflect a well-established and carefully considered and constructed balance of national law enforcement, foreign relations, and societal priorities. Bull. The nation's drug laws are an ad hoc ingathering of paranoid ignorance. I mean, Jesus Christ, the federal drug laws still schedule cannabis as the same thing as heroin. They're in the same class. Drugs with no medicinal value whatsoever, when in fact we've now got several years, decades, dare I say it, of research to show that, no, in fact, cannabis does have its certain medical side. Societal priorities. Yeah, I guess it's a societal priorities that we tear our country apart and wind up with more than 1% of our entire population in jail because of, you know, nonviolent possession offenses. The supremacy clause of the Constitution. There ain't no supremacy clause. Oh, wait, shh, don't let the kids know. The supremacy clause of the Constitution mandates that this Constitution and the laws of the United States which shall be made in pursuance thereof shall be the supreme law of the land, anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding. In passing and enforcing Amendment 64, the state of Colorado has created a dangerous gap in the federal drug control system enacted by the United States Congress. Marijuana flows from this gap into neighboring states. It flows. I don't think it flows. I think it might wander maybe from 7-Eleven to 7-Eleven, but it doesn't flow. undermining plaintiff states' own marijuana bans, draining their treasuries, and placing stress on their criminal justice systems. Wait, stop. What? So, until Colorado legalized cannabis, there was no cannabis trade in Nebraska-stan or Oklahoma-stan? God or whatever rest his soul, I think Bart Kopp would be a little surprised by that. How did he refer? Yeah, God's flowers. And I think old Bart was in possession of God's flowers on a rather routine basis there in Oklahoma-stan, and yes, it was in fact illegal. Colorado Amendment 64 obstructs a number of the specific goals which Congress sought to achieve with the CSA. Confederate States of America? Oh no, Controlled Substances Act, I'm sorry. I was just kind of thinking the way an Oklahoma-stan or a Nebraska-stan attorney general might think. Oh, the sun shines. No. By permitting, and in some cases requiring, the cultivation, manufacture, packaging for distribution, and distribution of marijuana, Amendment 64 undercuts congressional edicts, including the congressional finding that such distribution has a substantial and detrimental effect on the health and general welfare of the American people. So I guess Congress can make findings, because that's cited, you know, that's 21 U.S.C. Section 801, Paragraph 2, that although local drug trafficking may itself not be an integral part of the interstate flow of drugs, it nonetheless has a substantial and direct effect upon interstate commerce, yada, 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 on. Please, will you right-wing punk-ass dummies get on one side or the other? Either be states' rights fundamentalist neo-Confederates, or just acknowledge that, and you know, of course, along the way, nullificationists, or admit that all of that's a bunch of bull, and you really do want a strong, centralized federal government, because you can't have both. It'll make your head explode. Well, that doesn't matter to them now, does it? Meanwhile, while Oklahoma-stan and Nebraska-stan have filed suit, interestingly, other right-wing states, Arizona-stan, Kansas-stan, Utah-stan, and Wyoming-stan, neighbors of Colorado-stan, have not. Now, here's where it gets interesting. In his press release, Colorado Attorney General Southers said he would vigorously defend Colorado's cannabis law in court. However, in the past, he has not been shy about noting the fact that he does not like what the voters of Colorado Stan did in legalizing cannabis. But he says, my duty transcends how I feel about a law. I'll vigorously defend it. So if he walks into the Supreme Court of the United States and starts taking dives before the bell rings, we'll have a working understanding of what vigorous defense means in the mind of a right wing. And, you know, he's one of those people who's all worried about the fetuses. And he cares, he doesn't like cannabis, but he wants everybody in Colorado to have a gun. Right. So, like I said, we are not hurting by any way, to any degree whatsoever. We are not hurting for information this evening that creates the thorn in our side on this here Thursday. Under the subject line, I've got the original transcripts. Ron in Raleigh says, you got to read some of the outright racist testimony in the congressional hearings that led to the prohibition of reefer. Things like the fact that it emboldened Negroes to look white men in the eye. And other stuff like that. Yeah, I read somewhere once upon a time that the criminalization of cannabis and the .357 Magnum round were invented at about the same time. And for largely the same purpose. You know, those Negroes get all hopped up on the Mary Jane, and they're unstoppable, and that's why they invented a bigger, badder pistol round Because a 357 round is basically a 38 caliber slug with a whole bunch more gunpowder behind it. Because, see, even back then, those 6'4" demons would charge you with their head down, whether there was a psychotic lady known as Witness 40 there to watch it or not. And then this, which has absolutely nothing to do with cannabis, but it still will make you kick furniture. This. So I had no idea that over on Facebook, there is a group there called Vac Truth. And I have read this story repeatedly throughout the day, and keep sort of begging silently to myself, let it be a joke. Let it be a joke. Please, Jesus, let it be a joke. Please. But so far, my prayers have not been answered, and no research that I've done has taken me anywhere to indicate that, in fact, this is anything but in earnest. And that is from the, you know, this comes to you from the Department of, what the? No, really. This goes back to December 9th and is published at Addicting Info. Whoever it is that runs Vac Truth, and they've even got a URL, and this might be an appropriate time to suggest that you, I mean, do you really come to listen to the program without your hockey puck handy? Well, if you do, I'd have it nearby. I might go ahead and take that first initial good chomp on it, just to get it seated real good for later in the program. For the readers who have asked this question, this is from, Vac Truth. For the readers who have asked this question, which presumes that there are some readers who have asked that question, and, oh my God, do you think vaccinating a child with vaccines that are made up of endocrine-disrupting chemicals can affect the outcome of a person's sexuality? Homosexuality is found in nature in other species and has occurred in populations long before the advent of vaccines. Some, Fox News-style book, some believe vaccines affect sexuality, and some don't. By some do and some don't, we mean some believe that vaccines affect sexuality, and that's like two cranky people screaming at individual blades of grass and the entire rest of the world on the other side of the street. Some do, some don't. It is known that vaccines do disrupt hormonal function and can cause fertility and thyroid problems. So this is a legitimate question. Some people want to learn more about. You know, sometimes I read this insane right-wing gibberish and it feels like the poetic interpretation of Jabberwocky. We have a link for you discussing what some doctors have to say on the issue, but not in relation to vaccination status. In other words, we have a link below for you, which is absolutely useless to this question that we have made up in the thin gray settlings of our own tiny brains. Many people are afraid to bring this topic up and write about it. I'm not. I'm not afraid to bring it up and talk about it. I'm not afraid to bring it up and talk about it right here on this here radio program. Because to bring it up and to talk about it is to say, oh, Jesus, these people are stupid. I mean, these people are walking into doors with the lights on dumb. We know this is on some people's minds. So please respectfully share your experience. Uh-oh, we've gotten to Jeremy. OMFG, many, many dots and exclamation points and various other symbols from the symbol part of the keyboard. Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, is this stupid MF'er talking about? Oh, need much more duct tape and still need the NHL regulation hockey puck. Just barely got it there in time, didn't you, Jeremy? No. Thorn in the side Thursday. And by the way, the link that they provided there, according to Addicting Info, was to an article that asks if hormones can affect sexual orientation. So it was kind of circular. For those of you asking if vaccines can affect sexual orientation, here's an article that asks if hormones can affect sexual identification. Orientation. And who is this? Who is this delightful? Oh, this is John Prager over at Addicting Info, who is apparently cognizant of just how weird the right wing can get. And maintains, you know, on his own neurons remembrances of things past. Hello, Marcel Proust. About just how weird it can get. And thus, when reminded by this Facebook post, also remembered a certain radio host who is more than a little bit certain. Well, what it boils down to is these right-wing paranoids are constantly searching to figure out just what it is that causes the gay. Because being right-wingers of very little brain, they think that the gay, or teh-gay, T-E-H-gay, as it's spelled on the interweb tubes, teh-gay is caused by something as opposed to being simply one state of being as compared to another. Which it is. I mean, it's like there are red stars and yellow stars and big stars and little stars in the universe, and it's not that any of the stars are aberrant as compared to one another. They're just different kind of stars in the firmament. And firmament is probably a bad word to use, but what the hell? It's better than me saying stars in the fundament. So right-wingers, especially the paranoid variety, spend a boatload of time trying to figure out what causes teh-gay. I would like to know what it is that causes teh-stupid, that causes people to wonder what causes teh-gay. But here, then, is that famous radio host in his yellow snake t-shirt. Where's my snake t-shirt, Ma? To explain another thing that causes teh-gay.
But the reason there's so many gay people now is because it's a chemical warfare operation. I have the government documents where they said they're going to encourage homosexuality with chemicals so that people don't have children. I even catch myself, Bob, drinking out of these estrogen mimickers. In fact, you'll probably say it if it's lined with it inside the plastic packaging. I wonder if this spring water, natural lime flavor I'm drinking. I know full well HEB's putting fluoride in this. Why am I drinking this? I know full well these kettle chips say that they don't have MSG, but they've got the yeast extract thing that says it's MSG. What's wrong with us? Why won't we stop? Why am I so weak? And they know that they have immersed us in this, Bob.
God damn, it's like he's talking right to me. News Ninja Carol Baker pointing out, you know, my sexual orientation used to be vertical, but since I've gotten older, our sexual orientation is horizontal. Don't want to break a hip. Yeah, remember, all those ads are out there on television. Make sure your heart is strong enough for sex. And then, of course, comes the lovely footage of Alex Jones taking out his blunted end scissors. He's already eaten all the paste. And chopping open a juice box to find out where the part is that makes the little first graders all gay.
For those watching on PrisonPlanet.tv, here's the inside of this juice box. And if they zoom in any more, see that thin plastic? It's got it. And I'm letting my children drink this.
The gay is in the plastic, Mandrake. In juice boxes. Little children's juice boxes, Mandrake. Wow, and it's only 18 minutes before the hour. We're only 42 minutes into the program. It is, however, Thorn in the Side Thursday, so I consider, and our buddy the Angry Indian shared this with me earlier today. Hey, no fair calling me an idiot, Gerald. What the fuck is the idiot blabbering on about now? Well, pay attention, dang it! Texas Betsy. I think that was supposed to be an OMG. Has he spawned? Yes, there are little Alexes out there wandering around the Texas countryside. Blah. Oh, okay, Gerald. You meant the other guy, Alex Jones. Okay. Just checking. I mean, you'd be surprised the number of people who say, "What the is that idiot blabbering on about now?" And I generally answer them. Yes, he has spawned. No, it's and there, you know, there are onionish, not the parody site, but the pungent aromatic vegetable. There are onionish layers to this one. First of all, I need somebody to explain to me why it is that Martin Luther King III would ever, and I do mean ever, go on that program hosted by the man who wants to rub women down with falafel in the shower, you know, Bill O'Reilly. And I got no answer. Because, I mean, just, why would you? Because if you are a man of high melatonin content, and you go on we'll do it live. Everything sucks. And you go on O'Reilly's program, you know that you are going to be called upon to speak for every human being on the planet who ever has been born, is born, or may someday be born with dark skin. You have to be sort of the black person. And in this particular case, going back to, yay verily, last night, you know, when O'Reilly was having his ass handed to him in the ratings by SpongeBob SquarePants, because he does every night, Cartoon Network, Nickelodeon, whatever, beats the snot out of Bill O'Reilly. People talk about him being such a ratings monster. Bull. Did I say melatonin? I meant melanin. Oh, I must have turkey on the brain. Sorry, Devin. Thank you for calling that out. Melanin. Melanin enhanced. So, Bill O'Reilly has, for reasons that are beyond fathoming, he asks Martin Luther King III to be on the program. Martin Luther King III agrees to be on the program. At which point, because he's Bill O'Reilly, and because this is Thorn in the Side Thursday, he decides to explain to America what black people need to do. You know, Bill O'Reilly, black like me. I trust the hockey pucks are still in place. Good. Good, good, good.
From Atlanta, Martin Luther King III, the eldest son of Martin Luther King Jr., Mr. King is a human rights activist. So where am I going wrong, Mr. King? Where are you going wrong?
Getting out of bed, Bill? Telling women you want to rub them down, getting drunk and telling women you want to rub them down with falafel? Claiming you won awards that you never won? It's a long list, Bill.
I'm not sure that I can say where you're going wrong. What I would say is that our nation does need to hear a unifying message that brings us together. In other words, the African-American community may not always suggest that it is constantly a victim, but while there are victim situations, you can overcome those situations and become successful.
All right, and that's what I'm saying.
Oh, dear. He's apparently already said it once, and now he's going to say it again. Maybe louder this time.
And that's what one of the factor viewers from Colorado wrote in. But that's not what Samuel L. Jackson is saying. It's not what Al Sharpton is saying. And to some extent, it's not what President Obama is saying. See, I don't mind.
Oh, good. We've gotten to the part where Bill O'Reilly doesn't mind things. Because Bill, you know, when Bill
from Colorado wrote in. But that's not what
Bill O'Reilly tolerating things. Well, that really is the sort of thermometer. That is Bill O'Reilly's ability to tolerate things is the rectal thermometer of America. Yeah. Oh, by the way, back to Alex Jones. Alex Jones for a minute in his snake shirt. Michael and Madison pointing out, man, that is definitely Alex's greatest hit. That one is my go-to whenever somebody posts something about Jones and I need to swiftly destroy his credibility. Can't even remember how many times I've shared that clip. It's comic gold. There it is. There it is in the bottom of the box. Yeah. Okay, so let's find out what it is that Bill O'Reilly can tolerate.
What Samuel L. Jackson is saying. It's not what Al Sharpton is saying. And to some extent, it's not what President Obama is saying. See, I don't mind President Obama saying to LeBron James, hey, look, I'm with you, and that's what he did. But he also has to provide some leadership in the sense of saying just what you said, just exactly what you said. You know what? We fight the injustice, and we realize it's there, but we love our country. We applaud the progress we've made, and here is a pathway to success. You know, don't abandon your children. Don't get pregnant at 14. Don't allow your neighborhoods to deteriorate into free fire zones. That's what the African-American community should have on their T-shirts.
Now he's a fashion designer. You got that? Have you got that, black community? Bill O'Reilly wants everybody in the black community, presumably including Samuel L. Jackson and President Obama and Martin Luther King III, and yeah, okay, everybody has to wear a T-shirt. No word on color that says don't get pregnant at 14. No more of these I can't breathe T-shirts, damn it. No more of these justice for Tamir Rice T-shirts, damn it. No more of this, these hands up, don't shoot t-shirts, damn it. America is a great country full of greatness. And we need to have a Greatness America t-shirts, maybe. And every time a police officer slaughters a young black man in the streets, we need to, the black community needs to put on t-shirts that say, don't get pregnant at 14. Wow. Of course, my question, because I am, I'm very melanin challenged, not melatonin. Well, I'm probably melatonin challenged too, for that matter. But I'm wondering if maybe we can save a few of the, because see, we bear witness to it around here. I wonder if we can save some of those don't get pregnant at 14 t-shirts for white folks. Because we got our fair share of little white girls getting pregnant at 14. And, of course, I think there's the statistical evidence to support the fact that Precious Lumpkin, once she signs her purity pledge and goes to her purity ball with her daddy, as her date, really, she's statistically far more likely to wind up pregnant at 14 or 15 or what have you than, say, the children of little girls who have had actual, meaningful, serious sex education, as opposed to just being given abstinence only. No, honey, you just put this here aspirin between your knees, all right? And if he gets to the aspirin, ask him what you're going to name it. The aspirin? No, honey, you're not paying attention. We fight the injustice and we realize it's there. But we love our country and applaud the progress we've made. So what? Eric Garner was supposed to be applauding the gutting of the Voting Rights Act by the Supreme Court while he was, instead of choking out, I can't breathe. Is that it, Bill O'Reilly? Huh? Don't abandon your children. Because, you know, that's something only black people do. Don't get pregnant at 14. How's 15, Bill? Is 15 okay? I don't know. Is there any falafel around? Bill O'Reilly. Black man.
But we love our country. We applaud the progress we've made. And here is a pathway to success. You know, don't abandon your children. Don't get pregnant at 14. Don't allow your neighborhoods to deteriorate into free fire zones.
Just a quick question. Wouldn't that whole deteriorating into free fire zones thingy have something to do with the proliferation of firearms all across this country, thanks to the fine, upstanding, God-fearing, Bible-believing, Second Amendment-supporting denizens of the National Republican Rifle Association, of which I'm sure you're a proud effing member, Bill O'Reilly? Because if there aren't any guns, it's going to be a free rock-throwing zone. Oh, poor Carol. Carol says, I just chipped another goddamn tooth on this hockey puck. Does the horn offer a dental plan? Sorry. A dental plan's a bottle of cheap hooch and a pair of pliers, Carol. Shorter O'Reilly, all black people should wear t-shirts saying Negroes are the reason we can't have nice things. It's about the size of it. Of course, then I. What was the name? Somebody help me here. What was the name of the restaurant that Billo went to in Harlem? Sylvia's, wasn't it? And he was surprised that they offered him a fork with which to eat. Bill O'Reilly on race. You know, I'm surprised he hasn't come out with killing Dr. King yet. Killing Patton, killing Lincoln, killing Jesus. Killing Dr. King! The man wore a T-shirt. It said, "Don't get pregnant at 14. He squeezed the trigger slowly.
That's what the African-American community should have on their T-shirts. Am I wrong?
Yes.
Well, I think that's...
And bless his heart, you know, there's apparently a considerable amount of his daddy inside the being of Martin Luther King III, because he just blows right past the stupid.
Part of it, but that's not the entirety. I do think that my dad said that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. So, unfortunately, right now, the nation is focused on one segment instead of the whole. I think we need to use this opportunity to not just focus on that one segment, but to focus on the whole, so that we are addressing those issues just as we're addressing instances of police misconduct.
Okay. Do you think America's a noble nation?
Oh, absolutely.
Now, that's interesting, because your father was gunned down by a white racist, killed, his life taken. But yet you...
He was? What? Really? It's only fair to tell you that Martin Luther King III and Bill O'Reilly are not in the same studio. Otherwise, this hand may have reached across the desk and just snot-slapped Bill O. You know, your dad was gunned down by a white racist. I'm surprised you can think this is a noble nation. Did you know that it is only recently that Michelle Obama was proud of being an American? Oh, any minute now the Thorazine dart will kick in and I'll feel so much better.
His eldest son still believe that America is a noble nation. So could you explain that, why you believe
not only do I believe it, I know it. I mean, all you got to do is look at whenever we're whenever there's a natural catastrophe, whether it's a tsunami or whether there is a hurricane or a tornado, Americans come running to help.
Well, except for the Americans who are Republicans, who immediately take to the floor of the House to talk about there's no way we can possibly afford to fix this unless we cut some money out of the food stamp program. See, I guess if you're Martin Luther King III, you cannot say that America is not a noble nation. But it's not. That's not because I don't like my country. That's because the framers of this nation rejected ideas of landed or entitled or, you know, with the sword and the kneeling and the dubbing and, you know, nobility. They rejected that out of hand. They didn't want anything to do with it. They didn't want to be the... George Washington rejected outright a kingship that was offered to him. He was offered the monarchy of the new United States of America, and he said, "What? We didn't just do that whole revolution thingy to get a new king, and we don't need any dukes or earls or marquises or jacks or tens of diamonds or none of that. Noble nation." What would have happened? And we're just doing a little thought experiment now, because we're fond of those things. What would have happened if he would have answered, "Perhaps this is a noble nation, but it is also a flawed nation"? Because I'm thinking if anybody can get away with saying that America is a flawed nation, it's probably Martin Luther King III. because you cannot look at this country's long history of various and sundry abuses, slavery, misogyny, treating the native genocide, and say, well, no, definitely those are the hallmarks of a noble nation, you betcha. We gave them all a cigarette before we shot them, and a blindfold.
That's who we are at heart. Unfortunately, once that catastrophe is over, we go back to our corners and live separately. I'm not suggesting we need to live in crisis all the time. What I am saying is when there's a crisis, we don't ask, well, are you a Democrat? Are you a Republican? Are you gay? Are you straight? Are you black? Are you white? We come ready to help. That's
no, we saw that in 9/11 after 9/11. But now...
9/11.
Now, absolutely.
12 years later, we're seeing demonstrators in the streets of New York saying, kill the cops.
No, they're saying, stop letting the cops kill us. Bill.
We're seeing looting in Missouri, primarily by African Americans.
Oh, really? He's already judge and jury and just reached that conclusion.
We're seeing commentators saying the worst possible inflammatory stuff about their country, and an actor who's well-respected in the black community, Samuel L. Jackson, singing that stupid song that basically indicts all American law enforcement and, puts forth that, you know, we are living in a South African apartheid situation. And it's really insulting, I think. I think it's just insulting.
Aw, well, damn. Let's all go home. And put away, everybody put away the I Can't Breathe t-shirts and quit using the hashtags because Bill O'Reilly is insulted. My heart bleeds. Ron and Raleigh asking, didn't Bill O. the Clown say that he didn't believe in white privilege? So if he doesn't believe in white privilege, how does he presume to tell black people what they need to do? Shut the F up, Bill! Best advice he's ever gotten. Sergi pointing out that Bill O. also said of Sylvia's that he was surprised he heard no one say, Mother Effer, I want more iced tea. Like we can't order at a restaurant without sounding like Eric Cartman, who, incidentally, a cartoon character, is white. I don't know. I missed that part of the culture wars, Marty. Marty wants to know what song did Sam Jackson sing that raised Bill O's ire? Got no answer. Wow, where does an hour go? It's 3 minutes past the hour. We are still $130 away from meeting Robert's first part of the up over, down under, double down December challenge. This is kind of important. There's $130 to go. 13 people at 10, 10 people at 13, 26 people at 5, one person at 130, and that gets you the wild rice premium if you want it. Oh yes. And we also have a Hooterville Holler Ozark gift basket available for a $75 contribution, and several, I might add, several lovely horn bumper stickers available for a $50 contribution. They would go for a smaller contribution, but they cost a significant amount of money to print. That's all available for you if you run over and use the PayPal interface under the Contribute tab at headonradionetwork.com. Okay, Jeremy answering Marty's question. It was a song to peacefully protest police violence. It went viral on Facebook around Monday. Okay. I don't have it handy, but there you go. By the way, this would be at the top of the hour a good time to repeat Roger's message. Suggested interim measure on Texas and similar voter ID rules on the unacceptability of veteran ID cards as proof of voter being voter. While there aren't that many people as a percentage of the total population whose best or most readily accessible ID is their veteran's ID, this is a group worthy of thoughtful consideration. Whether their treatment at the VA is due to a physical wound or something less visible like PTSD, it is not grounds for the state of Texas or any other place to add them to the list of people that they think do not matter. If anything, that kind of treatment could exacerbate PTSD, and no one in the real world feels better after being told they don't matter any longer just because they can't go and serve in a foreign war for a corporate agenda. What I propose, until such time as the dignity of the person is restored, I would like to ask active duty members of the armed forces, whose ID is considered valid in these localities, to work on restoring dignified treatment of those who served with them or before them. Please, when you attend a political function or any place that politicians will be present, do so in uniform. Ask your politicians what their position is on your state's law regarding rejecting veterans' ID for voter ID purposes. Do not tell them what they should say. Just ask them to explain on the record what their position is and leave it at that. Please do not wait like the fake opposition groups that pretend to object to laws but always show up with too little too late to make a difference until a few weeks before an election to start doing this. Begin doing it now, not as a special endeavor, but as an adjunct to your current routine. At some point, the squeaky wheel principle from being reminded that they supported the original bill or have failed to propose fixing the current one should result in corrective legislation well in time for the next election cycle. Thank you for at least considering this. I believe we were all taught not to leave anyone behind. Signed, an old citizen who happens to be an ex-Marine. If you know an active duty member of the military, if you are one, consider that message. Okay. Thank you, Piedra. Going back to the Samuel L. Jackson question, he's saying, we ain't going to stop until people are free. YouTube's on video. Just search Samuel L. Jackson and click the top result. Okay. And Jeremy has now sent it to the Head On Radio Network Facebook group page. So if you're a member of that group, run on over. If you're not, ask, and I will happily add you to the number. All right. It is 8 minutes past the hour. We do, in fact, have many more thorns to which we can make reference. We've got plenty to go into, without a doubt. But this is also conversation radio, and I invite you to participate at your leisure. The numbers, of course, 304-574-8178, 304-574-8178, or the Gizmo line, which is 304-663-4676, 304-663-4676, that spells Horn, H-O-R-N, yes. And, of course, if you just want to use Skype to Skype, which is free the world over, well, you can use Bob Kincaid Horn Skype to Skype. Let's see, let's forego the break for the moment and go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
And good evening to you.
Good evening.
This is that Trucker John guy, whatever you want to call it.
Okay.
I don't know if you've noticed, but I've had a wonderful set of arguments today over since that Cromibus was signed.
Yes.
And I was a little disturbed about one thing that was kind of the absolute silence the media and everybody had to the pension cutting that was going on as part of that Cromibus. Nobody talked about it. And it was bothersome to me because, you know, workers are going to lose a good chunk of their pensions if this is what they're going to be doing.
And we're talking about defined pension plans, or are we talking about 401ks? Or?
Well, I didn't now that's what I'm a little bit hazy about because I read a couple of the articles, but the basic idea is that companies like, I believe, ABF and some of the trucking companies that, had long-term pension programs that have been around for years, they took such a hit back in 07, 08 that they've been losing a little bit of money and stuff. And one of the parts of the deal was that they were prohibited, I guess by law, to cut pensions. But the example that was used in the article I read today was that a person who was eligible to receive a $35,000 pension, however many thousand dollars a month that is, if the company so chose to do so in order to shore up their finances, they would be knocked down to $14,000.
Whoa.
And it's like I've been pulling it up on the internet and stuff like that, and it's there in the articles, but it was just like between all the screaming and hollering about the bankers getting all their stuff, no one bothered to mention too much about that. And I was like, what? You would think that would be the thing they'd be screaming about.
You would think it. And I'm not particularly cognizant of it. I apologize for that.
Don't apologize at all.
There's stuff in there that should not be in a spending bill, but it got stuck in there. Let me just ask you real quick, and we can certainly get back to the pension issue, John. But what is your understanding? There's some nasty business. There's some nasty business regarding people who drive truck.
Yeah, well, it's not so much nasty, but a lot of the companies were fussing about I think it was like middle of last year or the year before. The safety advocate groups were really screaming about driver safety and everything, and they put in the trucking business, if you are like an over-the-road truck or something like that, and you drive beyond a certain distance, you are subject to what they loosely call an hours of service requirement, which said that you are allowed to drive X number of hours a day, and then you had to take a break before you could drive more. And in the course of a week, you're allowed that if you're down for more than 34 hours, your time can be reset, and you get back your full. It's like a 70-hour allotment. And you get 70 hours a week, but if you say you drive 50 hours or, over the course of several days, you burn up 50 hours, but then you're stuck someplace for a day, day and a half, like a lot of times it might happen over the weekend. And then that would reset your hours back to 70 because you've had, quote-unquote, rest. Well, the safety advocates were very upset about that because if you work the numbers right, you could actually get about 82 hours a week of actual drive time within a 7-8 day period. And so they did the PATS and crashes and other driver safety organizations really pushed to put a limitation on the number of times per week you could do a restart. If you can only do it once a week, once every 168 hours to restart your time. And the companies were just upset as heck about that because it, quote-unquote, cut the productivity down and reduced flexibility and reduced, and it caused 15%.
Forgive me, but I despise that word productivity.
Oh, yeah.
Because productivity is a Harvard MBA word for making people work more for less.
Yeah, well, it's, As you probably have figured out from our conversations over the last few weeks since I kind of officially discovered you guys, you will find that I have rather peculiar and rather harsh ideas about the concepts of money. And, you know, when I hear, like, I'm like you, I hear productivity, I hear, people who don't work trying to make money off people who do.
Bingo! I think that really says it much better than I did.
And so what they're talking about, like as these hours of service is that they're basically the rules that have been changed to prohibit unlimited number of restarts and what have you. And part of the restart was a requirement in the revised rules that said in order for a restart to count, you had to take at least 2 nights where you were off during that entire 34-hour period. You had to have 2 periods of time of like 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. in the morning, because a lot of the doctors and stuff believe that, you know, people are kind of like circadian rhythms and stuff like that, and that's the best time to sleep, and it's the best time to rest, and you don't want to keep interrupting them. So a lot of people were doing restarts where they'd start at 2 in the afternoon and then start again at 3 in the morning, a day and a half, you know, 34 hours later. And
yeah.
And it was all kinds of, you know, people were just taking whatever time as advantage as it was. So if you ended your duty at a certain time, you actually were doing more than 34 hours. You might actually have to do, you know, 41 hours or something like that in order to get those two windows encompassed in that to count for a restart. And the companies were just absolutely having a fit over that because, you know, according to them, well, you know, you got customers that unload at 2 o'clock in the morning and blah, 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 and they can't do this. They were just screaming about this, and there's been a lot of pressure put on Congress and the congressmen in Capitol Hill to try to get this overturned. And, I believe it was Susan Collins who was the sponsor of that little, add-on to the trash heap that got passed.
Susan Collins, who probably could not find first gear in sort of vehicle that you drive.
Yeah, I'm not even sure. I'm not even sure if she's still in. Several of these so-called Democrats and lightweight Republicans stuff were on their way out. So it was like, I'm not being reelected. I've been kicked out of office, blah, blah, blah. I'm just going to get whatever little last-minute piece of slop in there. And, you know, I'm all for democracy, but that's, you know, When Mitt Romney says corporations are people too, I guess he meant that they have all the rights and we don't. Because, holy moly, I mean, I've gone through about 2/3 of it now, and it's like, Christmas came.
And I think, you know, I think maybe part of the reason that some of these other issues are not necessarily getting the time that they deserved is because the issue, the big stuff in there, like, you know, when a progressive member of the United States Senate stands up and says that she is incensed and disgusted by a bank giveaway that was written by Citibank that basically puts us back on the dime for their gambling habit, then that's, I guess that's what the media pick up and run with. I mean, does that make sense?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's CNN, all of them do the same thing. If one person is way out in front in the polls, the news media is going to do everything they can to build up the opposition or take down the front runner because, as far as they're concerned, I've said this before, when they got CNN, all the rest of them are now part of entertainment divisions of big corporations like GE and stuff like that. And their interest is making money. And for them, making money is to create as much chaos and controversy so people will be sitting at their chairs, looking at the TV, watching the horse race. And they manipulate the heck out of these stories. And, you know, and Elizabeth Warren, she's, you know, really that's, you know, a lot. I've got some friends that are still in the media services in D.C., and they're saying kind of off the table, they're saying that this coming election in 16 – on the Democratic side, promises to be boring.
Because it's just going to be a coronation of Hillary?
Yeah, pretty much. Because there's very few Democrats that are going to be willing to go up against her. And, you know, and I'm, you know,
and,
I,
and,
I'm
you know, gonna, and you know what? I'm I'm not taking cards in that game yet for a very simple reason. I have been, not that I sit around listening to him, but I used to be in a position where I spent a lot of time driving and I would hear a lot of Rush Limbaugh because it was the only damn thing on the radio. And I listened to that man start in 1992 squalling that, my friends, that Hillary Clinton will be president by 1996, or, you know, she'll definitely be president in 2000. Oh, she's definitely running in 2004. And he's been coronating her the Democratic nominee for damn near 20 years now.
Well, the Clintons have always been the boogeyman in the woodpile for the Republicans because, you know, despite all the entertainments that Bill Clinton got involved in, trying to be polite here.
Yeah, no, he whipped them. He whipped them every time they stood up.
Yeah, he whipped them. He was popular, and people have a nostalgic, you know, memory of the 1990s. Jobs were good. The economy was doing fairly well. Stock market was doing good. We the only wars we were involved in were little small bombing runs and other things. It was a, you know, what's that word you guys use? Halcyon or Halcyon?
Oh, Halcon. Yes, Halcon.
Yes, you can probably tell I read a lot, but I don't listen to a lot of people who actually speak the words, so I can't talk very well either.
Don't worry about
and,
it.
And it's like, you know, the Clintons are, you know, they're the boogeyman. They're the boogeyman to the Republicans, and the Democrats, unfortunately, you know, I mean, Bernie Sanders, he's nibbling around the edges of thinking of running, but if he does, he's going to get his butt kicked. And, you know, it's just...
Well, maybe he will, but the question with Bernie is whether he will run as an independent or as a Democrat. And I guess he's pretty much feels like he's done. I mean, I don't know the answer to this for certain, John, but it would pretty much be the close of his political career, would it not?
Well, he's the rumors in D.C. says that he's part of the reason why he's considering running is that he's about done with it anyway.
Yeah.
That's Hillary Clinton's problem is, disrespect to the woman, but she is getting a little bit long in the tooth. This is going to be basically her last chance.
Well, but she's a lot younger than, say, Reagan was.
Yeah, but do you really truly think that the American people would, you know, are ready for a woman?
I kind of halfway dread, and I'm not trying to be rude, I kind of halfway dread a Clinton candidacy, just because, and this is an example of how the other side wins. I'm absolutely fatigued. I'm wore out. I'm bushed. I'm whipped. I'm licked. From 6 years now of Obama derangement syndrome, and Obama-itis. And if you think for 1 minute that the exit of Barack Obama from the White House is suddenly going to turn the Republican Party into a bunch of people who play by the Marcus of Queensberry rules, well, you know, I got a bridge, and we should talk. You might want to buy it, you know?
Well, the seed of the Obama syndrome, as you call it, started in the Clinton years.
Sure.
I mean,
And the seed of that arises in the attacks on Michael Dukakis, and the seed of that goes back to how absolutely crazy they got over the election of Jimmy Carter. Because remember, every Democratic presidential nominee from Carter forward has been the most liberal human being ever to run for the presidency. I mean, like I said the other night, if the Democrats nominated Genghis Khan, the Republicans would be right out there the next day screaming, "Hey, he's a liberal. He's the most liberal Democrat ever to run." You know what I mean? And part of it has to do, and the other thing they love to do is, well, that Barack Obama, he's just another Jimmy Carter. And I'm not one of those people who's willing to say Jimmy Carter was a terrible president.
Well, Jimmy Carter is, you know, he was good for what he was at the time he was. You know, he got if he had not gotten caught up in that hostage deal, chances are he would have won re-election. But, you know,
well, and if the dirty tricks that were done by the Reagan campaign had not been done, he probably would have won won re-election. I mean, it's not even contested anymore. The Reagan campaign went to the Iranians and said, listen, don't turn loose of the hostages. We'll make it worth your time.
Yep.
And somehow or another, Ronald Reagan is still considered to be a great American after hanging our hostages out to dry? It boggles the mind. But then again, maybe not, because how many Americans even know that fact?
Well, remember, you know, it's not like you have Walter Cronkite sitting behind a desk in a news operation that was basically subsidized, money losing. I mean, the NBC News, ABC News, CBS, they were all part of television networks, and every single one of them lost money. They were part of that whole fairness doctrine, and you had to have a certain amount of your airtime, had to be for public interest. And they ran these things literally at a loss, and they accepted that loss because it was a public service.
Well, and because there was a mindset back then that said that the news division was not something that was part of the profit motive. And a lot of media historians and media analysts point to, in particular, the rise of Rune Arledge at ABC when he was put in charge of the news division as the beginning of the end of that notion. Because, you know, Rune Arledge had been the man who brought us every Sunday afternoon we had to watch that poor ski jumper, go through the fencing and fall off the jump and the agony of defeat. And of course, that was all, you know, that was all profit stuff. And it was when Rune Arledge came over to run the news division that suddenly news was understood as something that had to carry its own weight. And then, as you note, you get the elimination of the fairness doctrine. So, I mean, I remember John being a little boy and seeing the general manager of some TV station, maybe it was WBRC in Birmingham or WHNT in Huntsville, come on with some editorial comment at the end of the evening news, and then inevitably there would be somebody who they would put on, and God love them, I think they enjoyed doing it, because they would take the absolute most scabrous, wacky, loony, smelling like rot gut liquor, eyes crossed, you know, little stars and bubbles popping around their heads type to sit and give an opposing view.
Yeah, even if the opposing view was, you know, the 10% fringe population. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's the one sad thing about, you know, I've always thought in some ways that, this, you know, is that we would have been so much better off in the long run had we had a more parliamentarian type government rather than this, you know, winner take all slash and burn routine.
I think so too. And of course I draw a lot of my conclusions from the teaching that I get every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday from Dr. Bill, and have been getting. You know, I've basically had the privilege of being a tutored master's and PhD candidate level of instruction from Dr. Bill for 7 years now.
Yeah,
and you know, you go back and you look at the origins of the Constitutional Convention, and basically you find Hamilton and Madison coming up with a governmental structure that they felt like would be sufficiently controllable relative to the wealth class in the young United States. And they didn't want a parliamentary system because they didn't want a monarch, and they didn't necessarily want a parliament because they didn't want everybody they didn't want everybody having an equal voice.
Oh yeah. I mean, you go back, and if you get the opportunity to read some of the private papers that are in some of these libraries for these, what I call the first families of the Constitution.
Well, yeah, and even not just that, but just go and read the Federalist Papers.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll show you pretty clearly what they were up to. And, you know, we need to understand that, and that's why I kind of kick furniture every time I hear some politician, and it matters to me neither whether they are Republican or Democrat. I go a little nuts when I hear them say something about our democracy. And, you know, they get that reverent, hushed tone in their voice, our democracy. And I, what democracy? There's no democracy. In point of fact, during the Articles of Confederation period, there were serious experiments in real democracy taking place in the several states, and that's part of the reason that they had to call a constitutional convention, was to stop that stuff. Because real democracy was a real threat to the money.
Yes, that's both America's great benefit, and it's also its great curse, is that, you know, the religion of the United States is a green altar with a bunch of green pieces of paper sitting on it.
Well, there you go. But I also find it interesting to note that, what was it, way up into the 19th century, there were great swaths of the United States where the legal tender was the Spanish piece of eight.
Yeah. Yeah, back in my young days when I was playing D&D and stuff like that, and, you know, of course, you play games like that, you'd be, you know, trying to put your world together and everything. And, you know, if you're like a really anal kind of person, you'd want that world to have some little bit of reality to it, as it were, you know, strange word you'd use for that. But, and it actually got into some pretty big arguments with some of the players. It's like, you know, I would say, you know, hey, and they were like, oh, we got all this treasure. And I said, great, how much, you know, and they counted up and it's thousands of gold pieces. And I'm saying, fine. And they go, well, we're going to cart it out. And I'm saying, yeah. Did you bring a wagon? What do you mean?
What wagon?
You got 25,000 gold pieces. They're not light.
Yeah, gold's heavy.
And they're like, oh.
And you know, that had its own real world consequences, because back during the assault on Tenochtitlan, Mexico City, after the Mexica people had brought everything that was made of gold that they had to give to Hernan Cortes in hopes that he would go them away, they wound up having to run him out of town, and on the way out of town, a bunch of his soldiers tried to stuff as much gold as they could into their pockets, and Tenochtitlan sat on a marshy island that had been artificially raised up above the water level and had these causeways going across. And as they ran across one of the causeways, loaded down with all this gold, the damn causeway collapsed, and it's never been found to this day. It just sank into the mud.
Yeah. It's little tricks of history, as it were.
Yeah, indeed.
But, I just thought that whole pension thing, though, was the thing that's... I was just so amazed. I mean, I brought it up, and I got into an argument today at one of the truck stops, and I was amazed. I said, and they were like, oh, that damned Obama, he finally did something good for us. And I'm like, really?
Sorry.
And I go, what did he do? Oh, he got rid of those damn that bullshit with the hour and service and stuff. I said, yeah, okay, that's all fine and dandy, but do you think he gave it to you, or did he just accept it? And I, you know, it's to this, you know, I guess maybe I'm kind of echoing you, but, you know, I guess in a way, I'm very disappointed.
I'm going to do, next time I talk to Boss Man Wayne, because he pays attention to these things with a real keen eye because of the nature of his work. I'm going to ask him about it, and I bet you, I'll find out the skinny straight up.
Yeah, like I said, it's possible, and I may have misread something, but you know, it was one of the things that they were arguing about, and over a couple of little podcasts I've been listening to over the last couple of weeks, as this thing was, you know, coming to its head, and I mean, it's when you turn an entire people into effectively wage slaves, and the president who ran 6.5-7 years ago it was an amazing metamorphosis when he was just running as an outsider and he hadn't won Iowa yet, and it was all this, you know, and some excitement was starting to build, but Hillary Clinton was still ahead and everything. And he was talking single payer. And he, you know, we're going, if I were to become president, we're going to put some clamps down on that NSA and spying and all that blah, blah, blah. And I just amazed me that as I watched, the closer they became, he won Iowa. He started getting closer. And then suddenly New Hampshire and stuff, and suddenly it became real. He wasn't just some state senator, you know, the senator that, state senator becomes senator, and then he'd barely been a senator for a couple, 3 years, and now the White House was actually looking realistic. But the entire time, the harder he was running, the closer it became, the more he kept backing off.
Well, a lot of people don't remember, John, that Hillary's health care plan was actually more liberal than Barack Obama's was. I mean, it was.
Oh, yeah.
But let me just offer this caveat then, and I don't dispute what you have just said. Let me offer this caveat. You know, I trust by now my theory of the presidency as imperial administrator.
Mm-hmm.
You are never going to get, and I hesitate to use the word never, but I feel pretty comfortable about this. You're never going to get a president of the United States, barring entry into the presidency in the teeth of a monumental crisis with a compliant, or not even compliant, but an agreeable Congress. You're never going to get some sort of liberal progressive president who's going to do the stuff that we want him to do, because empires do not behave that way. I mean, the window of opportunity, FDR takes office in March of 1932? Or March of 1933. March 1933, the 1932 election, unless I'm off by 2 years. He only has a Congress that will really, really work with him for two or three or four years. Now, it remained a Democratic majority, but they began to splinter. So it's a very, very narrow window in which he gets the Fair Labor Relations Act passed, the Social Security enabling legislation passed. It's very narrow indeed, because by 1936, as America is beginning to slowly emerge from the recession, people on his side of the aisle, like what was his name, Henry Morgenthau, begins to holler, "Oh my Jesus, inflation, the deficit, oh my God, you know, brugge, brugge, brugge." And so FDR takes his advice, and lo and behold, we throw ourselves back into depression again. People don't know that. And so come forward in time, the window of opportunity in which LBJ gets the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act passed and the Great Society legislation passed is, again, quite narrow. The legislation that was passed during the Civil War with Abraham Lincoln as president and the noxious Southern contingent out of the Congress is very narrow. And so it's only at times of significant crisis that we make significant progressive change. Because I think that this country structurally has by virtue of the fact that it's capitalistically driven, it has a conservative, money-oriented bent. I mean, how long was it after the crash of 2008 and Obama's entry into the presidency in 2009? How long was it before the deficit hawks started squealing deficit, deficit, inflation, inflation, even though people who actually knew what the score was, like Paul Krugman, were sitting there saying, you gotta spend your way out of this one, and instead we get the new normal. I mean, my God, the stock market opened today, went up again. and the market is going up and up. And hell, did it cross 20,000? It may do that by New Year's. I don't know, but it's not translating to my life. It's not translating to your life. It's not translating to the world, be they right, left, or center of working America. And God knows it's not translating to the world of the poor.
Well, you know why, don't you? It's the very nature of how our money is made. When you people say, well, the government makes the money, but that's not true. About 90% of the money that's made in this country is made by the private banking system. The people who go in for credit and loans for houses, cars, or whatever, or credit card debt or whatever. That stuff is all created by private banks. And when you have to charge an interest rate and you have interest rates and all that attached to it, there's a natural gravitation that stuff's going to flow up to the ownership class. And if you stop and think about it for a moment, this country is a modern 21st century feudal state. The only difference is that it may not necessarily be a guy sitting in a big chair somewhere owning it, but you've got a corporation.
It's an oligarchic plutocracy.
Yeah, and it's your house that you're paying a mortgage on. If you really sit down and be honest about it, back when I was young and had a life, I used to toy around with libertarianism, and I'd do little speeches for them and stuff, and I would sit there and during the meets and greets and all that horse mess, people would be meeting me, how you doing, and we'd get ready to have the little speechifying that I do, and I would ask a question when I first stand up, and I would say, how many of you own your own home or property? And on average, you get 7 out of 10 people stick their hand up. I'll say, okay, well, let's keep that in mind. And then I do my little speechifying thing, and I won't bore anybody with that mess now. But at the end of the thing, I would go, dang, I forgot. How many of you own your own home or have property? You might get one hand go up.
Yeah.
Because by the time I finish, they're going, wait a minute, I don't own my own home. The bank does.
Sure. And
it's just the way it is. You know, when you buy a can of beans, you're not buying a can of beans. The beans is just a benefit. You're paying a financial transaction that, as a side bet, you get some beans to go with it. But you're paying for the office building. You're paying for the bonuses that the executive's going to take home with him. You're paying for the real estate investments that a guy goes and buys a building, and some company's in that building and doing their thing. Well, part of what you're paying for those beans is going to pay that real estate that's going to make some guy who owns that building rich. But you receive no benefit.
Right. And instead of talking about beans, for instance, this translates much more clearly into, say, the health insurance, where the overhead is monumental. And look at the overhead on 401ks or stock market portfolio holdings as compared to the administrative cost of the Social Security program.
Exactly. You know,
they're dramatically higher. By the way, we got an answer coming in from Michael in Madison, John, about Bernie Sanders and our exchange regarding him. Bernie has pledged, Michael says, on multiple occasions not to pull a Nader, that he won't be a spoiler. I don't think there's any question anymore that if he does indeed run, that he'll run as a Democrat. He realizes American politics and Vermont politics are two different animals. I don't like to make predictions, Michael continues, but I'd put more money on that Bernie won't run as an independent than on Clinton running at all. I'm still not 100% convinced that she will. Personally, I'm all for Bernie running as a Dem. He'd make a much bigger splash than Kucinich ever did. He's infinitely more media savvy and personable. He has a knack for speaking plainly, yet passionately, about progressive liberal populist ideas without coming off as abrasive or overly partisan. He won't lose his temper, he won't get trapped in a silly UFO question, and he won't personally attack his opponents. As such, he'll be far more viable. Just my two cents, because I don't have a magic eight ball, signed Michael. So thank you, Michael, for that.
Clears up a lot.
Yeah, and by the way, going back to questions about Secretary Senator Mrs. Clinton, Carol points out, after 8 years of President Blackenstein, I don't think America's ready to tolerate 8 years of President Vagzilla. And that's what it is. We're going to go from 8 years of wild-eyed racism resurgent to a level of misogyny that probably even those of us who think that we really, really know how awful the other side can behave in this country, we're going to be shocked by it. It's going to be disgusting because, see, I've already heard all the Hillary jokes, and they're going to come back with a daggum vengeance, John. I swear to you, I promise.
Yeah, I mean, although she has said she's not going to, I'm in that wishy-washy phase right now, but I actually do have a kind of a back of the head, you know, if I'm secretly at night, you know, kneeling next to my bed, doing my little prayers and, you know, eating my little hidden chocolates that I keep hidden away. I almost wish Elizabeth Warren would run.
I understand that, but I mean, and I'm not a betting man, mainly because I don't have I don't have the dough to bet with. But I'd almost lay big money that she will not. She's not dumb, and she knows she's a freshman senator, and mm-hmm. she knows that she's occupying Ted Kennedy's seat in the Senate, and she knows how much effect she can have in the long run. Even with this Congress coming up and being in the minority, she can affect. She can have a rather profound effect because she can be the rallying point, and has proven herself already to be the rallying point for progressive people in this country. I guess because there aren't a whole lot of them. But my God, when she came down here and stumped for Natalie Tennant in West Virginia. A woman who could not be, who could not even be bothered to acknowledge that her own, the people she wanted to represent were being poisoned and killed by mountaintop removal. Well, I mean, that tells you that it was perceived that Elizabeth Warren had some sort of cachet, and she went down and stumped for pro-coal, what's her name, Allison Lundergan Grimes in Kentucky. She is already just, you know, barely into the first term of her Senate career. She is already a superstar.
Yeah. Well, remember, that's pretty much the same path that Obama took. And so, you know, like I said, I agree with you as far as intellectually, but, you know, the thing that I'm worried about is, again, you know, a Clinton presidency. I mean, we've already now heard that Jeb Bush is pretty much in the game. So here we are back again with the whole Bush-Clinton. And there was a fascinating conversation on one of the podcasts where, tongue-in-cheek, mind you, the two commentators were kind of tongue-in-cheek talking about, you know, like 2050 and the near monarchy of the presidency being swapped back and forth with, you know, President Chelsea Clinton is leaving office, and the new president will be,
George P. Bush.
Yeah, George P. Bush the fourth or fifth or something like that. Yeah. I was laughing.
Yeah, and see, he'll be our first Mexican American president.
Yeah.
And that'll be the hitch there. I think it's almost dead certain. It looks like, well, maybe not. But Jebby is certainly making his he's not being shy about it. He's going to form a pact to find out that if he should blah 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 blah. But the numbers are beginning. It's him and Willard Romney, the bishop, going back and forth in the early right wing preference polls, and Rand Paul and that thing on his head are down there about 5%, but. Jebby and Romney go back and forth at 19 and 14, 19, 15, 16, 18, that kind of stuff. By the way, we got an answer coming in. We got an answer coming in regarding the pension question.
Oh, great, because I said I'd be looking at my little phone does the internet thing, and there's articles all over the place, but I couldn't get as deep into it as I'd like to.
From an article on the Naked Capitalism website. Oddly or not, progressive and Democratic loyalist commentary on the Cromnibus bill has, with occasional honorable exceptions, focused almost exclusively on Elizabeth Warren's fight against a derivatives provision that might benefit big banks, as we saw yesterday, and has been silent about a provision that could do far worse and far more immediate harm to working people who made their retirement plans based on the belief that their pension rights were secure and backed by legislation and the idea that a contract was a contract. So in this, the writer says, so in this post, I want to rectify that mysterious silence and take a look at the truly nauseating Klein-Miller Amendment. That's the name of it. Passed by the House and part of the Senate bill forwarded to Obama for his signature. David Dayan summarizes, under the bill, trustees would be enabled to cut pension benefits to current retirees, reversing a 40-year bond with workers who earned their retirement packages. Michael Hilzik says, and I don't know who any of these people are, under ERISA, the 1974 law governing pensions in the private sector, benefits already earned by a worker can't be cut. Now they can. That's right. Even if you're retired and vested in a private pension plan, your benefits could be cut. Congress retraded the deal, if I have the finance jargon right. That's nauseating, even for today's official Washington, and the bill was passed in a thoroughly bipartisan fashion. Klein is a Minnesota Republican. Miller is a liberal California Democrat. Reach me that bucket, would you?
Yeah, that's that pretty much reinforces what I was talking about. I thought I'd seen it right,
but
I couldn't pull it up. I couldn't pull it up directly out of my head. And that's what bothers, and that's part of what sparked me to call, because that truly bothers me. Yes, the derivatives. Yeah, I'll give you one statistic that'll blow you, that's been repeated to me multiple times, that'll blow your mind. In 2007-2008, the what they call the nominal value of the derivatives that were outstanding when Lehman Brothers blew up, $237 trillion.
Yeah.
Of the bets and counter bets and all the other mess going on. Well, last month we passed 260 some trillion. So all the money that the Fed's been cranking out, that's what the quantitative easing was all about. The Fed would crank up all this free money. They turn in their certificates for all these derivatives, and the Fed would give them, quote-unquote, nominal value, and now the Fed is holding on to a vast amount, trillions of dollars of this, like $2 or $3 trillion worth of this crap paper, mortgage paper, in order to keep the bank solvent on paper. We are winding up, and now you've got these politicians, and this, like I said, this is what bothered me so much. They passed this. Obama signed it yesterday with nary a comment.
Peep.
Not a word. And yet, of course, it's popular to scream and holler at the bankers and their ways. That's bad enough. But to let something like this, when you're telling, the example that I read in one of the things was, and I think I mentioned it earlier, was that a truck driver, the example he used was a truck driver that drove for one of the, like overnight, that's ABF or something like that. His pension was like $35,000 a year. They're projecting that if the company that manages that fund gets to do everything that they want to do, his pension is going to be chopped down to about $14,000-$15,000. That's just flat freaking robbery. And this, you know, it's probably some poor old guy, probably well into his 60s, you know, looking forward to going out and, you know, maybe doing a little fishing and, you know, taking a little missus on a little vacation. And then if this thing goes plays through, he's going to have to be standing at Walmart going, welcome to Walmart.
Yeah, if he could get that, John.
Yeah, and that's, well, like I said, that's kind of what sparked me, because it was like, hey, but I see I've jabbered myself into oblivion here, so let me let you go.
Well, you have not at all. It has been a fascinating conversation, as it always is, and you are always welcome to participate here. That's, I mean, you know, that's the nature of conversation radio, John. We're not going to hurry anybody away who's bringing a lot of content to the table. By all means, stay safe. There's a lot of bad drivers out there this time of year, and even I saw the weather report for around Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, and it looks like it's going to be just total crap. So by all means, be careful.
Oh yeah, I plan to be sitting at a buffet table, getting fatter, doing my part to keep the economy going.
Hot diggity. Well, you take care, John. Good to hear from you.
Bye bye.
Bye now. From somewhere out on the road. That's our buddy John, and wow, I had no idea. And how can you, unless you're sitting there poring over everything? And I don't even know that if I'd had the bill in front of me, that would have leaped off the page at me. But that's, Jesus, no, really, I'm going to ask Boss Man Wayne about it. I imagine he's probably already having a hissy. So we are at 6 minutes before the hour. We are almost two hours into the program. And I got to, look, I'm not complaining, but this is disturbing. We had a $75 challenge on the table two nights ago. It blew by without being matched. We lost that. Now we got a $150 challenge on the table. And so far we have precisely $20 toward matching that. And this is kind of critical because if we match this, then Robert said he'll do it again tomorrow night. He'll double whoever's contributing. He'll double their money tomorrow night too. Up to 150 tonight, up to 150 tomorrow night. It's a double down end of the year, up over down under challenge. So hopefully, thank you Thomas and thank you Carol for getting us started on it. Hopefully there will be more interest. If you haven't contributed to the Horn in a very, very long time, this would be a great time to double your money. That having been said, we'll take a little break. The Green News Report is on the way. I always enjoy those, especially, you know, it's every Tuesday and Thursday. And there's only one more left for the whole year. There'll be one on Tuesday, and then nothing more. I guess Brad and Desi are going to take some Christmas holiday time, and bless their hearts for doing it. They work awfully hard. So, yeah, break coming, Green News Report, 304-574-8178 is one number. We've got somebody on the gizmo line right now. And always, of course, Bob Kincaid Horn, Skype to Skype, if you want to try that. This is Conversation Radio, listener-supported. This is the Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
The latest news has struck me funny. It says you have no friends if you haven't got money. And all of us good folks are in distress, but I'm gonna get something off my chest. 1932 won't be long. When you place your vote, please don't vote wrong. Vote away the blues, the breadline blues. It's a rich man's job to fix some rules in order to live my breadline blues. Now listen, you folks, it ain't no joke. We're gonna do something or we're all gonna croak. I can't get a job, we've all been robbed. We got no money and the corn's all cob. Got nothing but the blues, the breadline blues.
Long-eared new standing over the box to the big mouth elephant, you drink like an ox. Had 8 years proved nothing but a curse, instead of making it better, getting worse and worse. Oh, the long-eared mule said, I ain't no fool. Said to the long-eared mule, well, shut your mouth, you never been to school. Well, the mule said, elephant, it ain't no joke. We better do something or we're all gonna croak. We're struggling to keep our head above water, but we're drowning in debt from the government order. It's the same old blues, those breadline blues. That struck me funny. Said you have no friends if you haven't got money.
Now all of us good folks in distress, but I'm gonna get something off of my chest. 2008 won't be long. When you place your vote, please don't vote wrong.
Vote away those blues. Club Red Line Blue.
It's Thursday, December 2014.
This has been probably the most emotion-charged issue that I've ever experienced.
New York issues the nation's first permanent ban on fracking.
This withdrawal prevents consideration of this area for any oil or gas leasing.
Obama permanently protects Alaska's Bristol Bay. Plus,
this bill was completely preventable.
More accountability, more indictments for Freedom Industries' West Virginia toxic chemical spill.
All of that surprisingly good news and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
You can find gas for less than $2 a gallon in 13 states.
Less than $2 a gallon. That is so cheap. Now, I just don't fill my tank. I fill up the whole damn car.
Oh, farewell, Stephen Colbert, and thanks for all the snark.
It's exciting, but it's dangerous.
This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, aside from the very, very sad news about Stephen Colbert going away, I'm going to miss him terribly. A surprising amount of very good news here as we head into the holidays. Is that my imagination, or is that really what we've got?
No, it's been a banner week for public health and the environment.
That never happens. Nobody ever says, oh, great, I want to hear the good news from the Green News Report.
Well, today they will. It's the first statewide ban on fracking.
So the question becomes, what is it? Is it a great job generator, or is it a danger to public health or the environment?
That was New York Governor Andrew Cuomo answering that question when he announced on Wednesday that the state's temporary moratorium on fracking will now be a permanent ban. At a press conference, New York State Acting Commissioner of Health, Dr. Howard Zucker, said a long-awaited health study found disturbing public health and water supply impacts.
Would I let my child play in the school field nearby, or my family drink the water from the tap, or grow their vegetables in the soil? After looking at the plethora of reports, my answer is no.
Wow, who was that wild-eyed lefty activist again?
That was the New York State Acting Commissioner of Health, Dr. Howard Zucker. Now, Governor Cuomo also cited questionable economic benefits of fracking. He said the cost of new infrastructure, regulations, enforcement for local governments, and negative impact on tourism far outweighed any potential economic benefits. Critics called the move cosmetic, saying New York is just going to rely on natural gas that's fracked in nearby states like Pennsylvania and Ohio.
Good, let's ban it there too.
Well, speaking of Ohio, a fracking well blowout has been uncontrollably venting natural gas for 4 days in eastern Ohio.
I know how that well feels. Press on.
You know we're talking about drilling, right?
Just continue.
That blowout has forced the evacuation of 25 families from their homes the week before Christmas because officials say it could still catch fire and explode.
Okay, well, we couldn't have 100% good news on the Green News Report. It would give us a bad name.
Back to the good news, though. More indictments in the West Virginia toxic chemical spill. A federal grand jury on Wednesday indicted 6 owners, executives, and employees of Freedom Industries, charging them with flagrant violations of the Clean Water Act for the toxic chemical spill that triggered a drinking water ban for 300,000 people in Charleston, West Virginia, back in January.
And this follows on the news just a few days ago that the CEO of that company, Freedom Industries, was indicted and arrested himself.
That's right. Here's U.S. Attorney Booth Goodwin announcing the second set of indictments.
Through flagrant disregard of the law, Freedom and the people who ran it allowed one of those tanks to corrode so badly the thousands of gallons of MCHM poured out of that tank into the river and ultimately ended up into the pipes that bring water to hundreds of thousands of people here in this area. And this incident, this spill, was completely preventable.
Finally, more good news. President Obama this week permanently protected one of the world's most prolific salmon fisheries, Bristol Bay, Alaska, from oil and gas development and drilling.
Bristol Bay has supported
Native Americans in the Alaska region for centuries. It supplies America with 40% of its wild-caught seafood. And it's something that's too precious for us to just be putting out to the highest bidder. This withdrawal prevents consideration of this area for any oil or gas leasing for purposes of exploration, development, or production.
Desi, you refer to that as a permanent protection on Bristol Bay. Is that in fact permanent, or can another president come in after Obama and do away with this?
That is the catch. It is permanent unless the next president reverses it.
For much more on all of these stories and the ones we didn't get to, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Don't forget, you can download our reports anytime via Stitcher, TuneIn, or iTunes. Please give us a good review there if you don't mind. Find us and follow us on the Facebook and the Twitters at Green News Report. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Good News Green News Report.
Clap along if you feel like happiness is the truth. Because I'm happy. Clap along if you know what happiness is to you. Because
I'm glad they didn't use the line about clap along if you feel like a house without a roof. Because a roofless house is just not very damn happy. I mean, that's just my opinion. But hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. I don't think I even said that at the beginning of the program. It's 6 minutes past the hour, and let me check here. Yes, let us go. Oh, before I do, a little, you heard, and I didn't mention it on the program last night. Yes, the grossly, wildly, willfully, wantonly, negligent dumbasses who poisoned the water of 300,000 people have been indicted by the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of West Virginia, the same U.S. Attorney who indicted Don Blankenship, and the same U.S. Attorney who indicted Gary Southern, all on various and sundry federal charges. I think that's magnificent news. Don't get me wrong. But I would like to point out, just in case anybody's curious, that West Virginia actually has, I'm not kidding, real statutes against poisoning, dumping, polluting water. We do. We absolutely do. We tell average garden variety hillbillies about it all the time as they drive up and down our little hillbilly curvy roads. There's a fine for littering. But not even so much as a misdemeanor charge has ever been brought against that crowd. And no, it would not for a state charge would not foreclose a federal charge because they have entirely separate elements. But it says something to me that there is no one, there is no prosecutor in any county in the affected areas of the state of West Virginia where this water was poisoned who are willing to bring a charge against those asshats. Those, and I know you're still listening, Carol, those douche barges. Not one. Not the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection. Ha! Not the prosecutor of Kanawha County, not the prosecutor of Lincoln County, not the prosecutor of Putnam County, not the prosecutor of Logan County, not the prosecutor of Boone County, not the prosecutor of Roane County, not the prosecutor of Clay County. None of the nine counties have brought a single charge against a gang of profiteering, money-grubbing asses who poisoned 300,000 people. So, you know, I guess, we're going to have to rely on that thug federal government, right? That's got a war on coal. And now they got a war on coal chemicals. See how it works. Yeah, let's go to the gizmo line. Let me make sure everything is hooked up the way that it is supposed to be. Yes, it is. Is that you, Bill?
Are you talking to me, sir?
I do believe I am.
Yeah, well, I'm going to keep you long tonight. Something just came back, and I was talking about a congressman who was such a drunk? It was Wilbur Mills.
Yes, he was. Well, by no means is he a lone member of that list, but yes.
No, no, but he was running around having an affair with this, the old-time burlesque stripper, which is, of course, different from nowadays, the local bar, you know. Blaze Starr, her name was.
No, no, that wasn't Wilbur Mills. Blaze Starr was Earl Long.
Was it Earl Long? I thought it was Earl Long, and then somebody told me no.
Wilbur Mills was, because Wilbur Mills is up in the 70s, the 1970s, and I'm pretty sure, yeah, Fanny Fox.
Oh, Fanny Fox, too? Yeah.
Yeah, Fanny, I think Fanny Fox was the stripper with whom he had a dalliance. No, and that is, of course, not to cast any aspersions on the profession of being a stripper.
No, when I saw him, we had a burlesque theater here, and the comics were those old guys with the baggy pants and the oldest jokes in the world. Well, one of the ones that I will never forget, when this was probably Kennedy was still a president and alive, I think it was 63, when this guy talked about a new drug they were developing for potency, and it was from the Upjohn Chemical Company. I mean, the name itself, you know.
Yeah, right, yeah. No, the goddess of irony watches over us all.
Yeah, anyhow, it's... My pain in the butt right now is these dentists getting these teeth finished. A buddy of mine has a big open house every Christmas Eve because he's been in AA for 20-some years, and he has the open house for a lot of folks who don't have family, and it's always a good time, and the food's always excellent. And this guy was a great, real fine piano player. He was in the Jerry Lee Lewis School of Piano Players. You know, just... beat the living hell out of the thing,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But he was a fine player. There's so many of them around here. But anyway, I won't kind of tie up the line, but I knew I couldn't get it. I thought it was a long.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that was Blaze Starr. And of course, there was a movie by the same name, Blaze, I believe. But Wilbur, to be fair, Wilbur Mills actually tried to recognize that he had a problem and went on to found the Wilbur D. Mills Treatment Center for Alcoholism and funded a University of Arkansas Medical School Wilbur D. Mills Endowed Chair on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. He died in 1992, and yeah, he was out of hand. He was completely out of hand. The whole thing blew up when Park Police in 1974... It was 2 a.m., October 9th, 1974. He got stopped, pulled over by U.S. Park Police for not having his lights on. He was drunker than a skunk, and he'd been in a scuffle with a woman named Annabella Battistella, who was a stripper from Argentina operating under the name Fanny Fox. Yes.
But
meanwhile, Blake Farenthold of Texas does not have a problem. You know, his legal paper, because he wasn't arrested or anything, he's just being sued for being a sexually harassing pig. His spokesman said, he looks forward to responding to these baseless allegations. You know what? By the time you get around, but you don't put something like, the other women in the office would often have to go on redhead alert to protect him from making an ass of himself with women in at Capitol functions. You don't just make that up and put it specifically into your suit papers unless you're pretty sure you've got somebody who can get on the stand and talk about being on redhead alert with Blake Farenthold. And then there was the photo today that I saw over at Charlie Pierce's blog of Blake Farenthold at some party somewhere wearing, and I kid you not, and I think David Vitter probably wants them back and he's going to be pissed off about how stretched out they are. I'm not kidding. Blake Farenthold wearing adult-sized blue flannel rubber ducky print footy pajamas at a party.
Oh, for Christ's sake.
But he doesn't have a problem.
I never got a DUI. I was never arrested for being drunk publicly. In fact, the audience seemed to like it. When I would close out the evening, I always tell them, you know, two things I would say. You know, I'm glad the more you drink, the better we sounded. And the other thing was, if they stop you, don't ever tell them you're as sober as a judge.
No, they don't like that. No. No.
Yeah, well,
right, and try not to say, I'm not nearly as think as you drunk I am.
Yeah, that's interesting. But, yeah, you guys are, by the way, I'd like to hear Angry call in about this this giveaway of some land to some foreign investor.
Yeah, well, and it's not just any foreign investor, Bill. It's the Rio Tinto Company, and we're giving away... you know, we the people, giving away land that we don't own. It's Apache land. It is sacred land. It's where, among other things, their women go for the rite of passage into womanhood. We're going to let Rio Tinto just destroy it because they think that there's $1.92 worth of some metal under the ground.
Well, you and I know the whole problem with the Ukraine is they want to get in under that ground.
Oh, I don't.
And then was it Jim? What? Go ahead.
Well, no, yeah. I mean, among other things, they want to frack them out of it.
Yeah. Well, a friend of mine just lost a lot of money from a company. They offered her so much money for fracking, and then they didn't want to pay her the balance. They probably didn't find anything, you know. Well, maybe they did, and they still don't want to pay the other half. I mean, what are we living in? What year is this? Is this the 1890s?
This is the Gilded Age that Mark Twain railed against.
Yeah.
Only I think it's actually more dangerous, Bill, because it operates at the speed of light, whereas the telephone wasn't even in great vogue at the time that Twain was inveighing against it. I mean, you know, your Rockefellers and your Mellons and your Carnegies and JB Gottrocks and LQ Asshats. Well, they had a stock ticker, but they could not wreck an economy at the press of a single button in a microsecond. These boys can do that.
And you're hip to the poison water of Paris Island.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So it's all over.
Those people got told to go water, but
I'm afraid to drink it.
Well,
I lived in Lake County. We used to go out to a spring and fill bottles because the water, in August, the local water supply from the companies tasted so bad it wasn't funny.
Well, you know what W.C. Fields said about drinking water. Fish piss in that.
I remember I brought home some perch one time, and I thought I emptied the bucket, so I poured the water down the contraption, and I went in there a half hour later, there's a fish swimming around in the thing. And I got him out and put him in a bucket of water, drove 5 minutes to Lake Union and put him back in. You know, you're a survivor, you know? Get out of here.
Yeah,
you have more brains than I did.
Yeah, that one gets a reprieve.
Anybody? Yeah. Well, I don't know how you are about eating freshly caught fish, but...
Well, when it's safe, there's nothing better.
Yeah, really good.
There's nothing better. Yeah. I mean, I had fresh caught walleye up in northern Wisconsin. And,
oh, yeah.
And you know, I grew up, you know, being a southern boy, you grow up eating catfish. And when it's done right, catfish is tender and sweet and delicious. And trout, you know, trout's lovely. I've never had anything better than that fresh caught walleye up there. Oh my God. And I think I saw it, fresh frozen in my Kroger fish case down here. And I think, if I recall correctly, It was somewhere around $17 a pound.
Yep. And see, Lake Erie, Ohio has closed off a lot of Lake Erie to commercial fishermen. The Canadians are still doing it. And, you know, but it's so hard to... There's a couple places that... And there's a lot of new restaurants up here. There's one... I saw one of the Cavaliers. I went down and he hired a New Orleans cook. And he... And when I say it's, you know, crawfish interfering and that kind of stuff, and I'm dying to get a ride over and eat some of it. We had a place in Lake County that was run by a black family and was serving New Orleans food. And the assholes, the white people wouldn't go there, and the place went out of business, you know.
Oh, Jesus.
How can we go to a place, you know, where they are serving you? You know,
oh, my
that bullshit.
And you know, there's not a, it's not so much a racial component here. Beckley, West Virginia just beats the daylights out of me for its restaurant culture, because it's crazy. I've seen it happen three or four times now that somebody with, you know, world class credentials will open up a nice restaurant, and the damn thing will be shuttered inside of 6 months because people stay away in droves. Oh, but by God, you open up a Cheddar's or, and these are real world examples, a Cheddar's or an Olive Garden, and you know, damn,
yeah.
the lines out the door, and I'm thinking,
So my daughter used to take me to the Olive Garden, and I would just laugh. I said it's okay, but it's not what I'm used to from restaurants that were owned two or three generations of Italian families. Is that you know, and there's very few of them around anymore because, you know, people want to go to these franchise hamburger joints. It's like, give me a break, will you?
We walked into the and my buddy Rick Smith refers to places like this, you know, Golden Corral, Ryan's, refers to it as a trough.
Yeah.
It's a trough. And walked in, and I all three of us, it was Agnes, me, and Ferg that evening. And all three of us walked out of there absolutely hating ourselves.
Well, I enjoyed talking to her. We used to talk to Rick because, of course, when I used the Stress name, he right away knew me because he was a musician here in Cleveland at one point. And he grew up in a project on the west side of town. And I had looked at those. My family had looked at those things, and we stayed in one on the east side. But, yeah, Rick and I have a lot in common in boyhood, you know. Anyway, I'll let you go.
All right, you have yourself a good evening, and hopefully we will talk
you
again
too.
Soon, Bill.
Hey, everybody.
All right, gonna try. Bye now. Our buddy Bill, Mr. Stress, calling from fabulous Cleveland. And I mentioned it talking to John a little bit ago. I was looking at the weather map for next week, and it looks like there's just a great big blob of yuck all over the middle of the United States and up into the Northeast for long about Christmas Eve, Christmas. Now, you know, if you're into white Christmases and stuff, you might get one. But you might just get a boatload of freezing rain and miserable, yeah, right. my remarks on the culinary pedigree of Beckley. Marty asks, so you say Gordon Ramsay wouldn't open up there? Gordon Ramsay would go broke here unless he opened up a chain. We have no tolerance whatsoever in Beckley for actual cooking, which is kind of funny because if you go 15 miles to the north, much nearer me, a little town called Fayetteville, which has a sign on the highway that says, "Welcome to Fayetteville, America's coolest small town." There's all kinds of wonderful stuff. Hard to get a good plate of pasta, but there's an awesome pizza joint that's expanded all over the country. Or not all over the country, but they expanded significantly. One of the most delicious sandwich joints that I've ever tried. Used to be a good Mexican place with some actual cuisine going on. It's slid downhill. Nice place doing Cajun and low country cooking, the only one in West Virginia that I'm aware of. And none of them are chains. Of course, out by the highway, we got Boob Evans and the clown and the redheaded right-wing fascist girl and that gelatinized stuff that passes for roast beef that isn't Roy Rogers and... Yeah. So that's our food porn, I guess. By the way, good news. Good news. Very good news. Thank you to Ron, and thank you to Ryan, and thank you to Ralphs, and of course thank you to Thomas and to Carol. We have met Robert's Thursday night half of the fundraising challenge for the Up Over, Down Under challenge. Robert wrote in just a little bit ago and said, come on, people. If everyone listening chipped in just $2 tonight, we'd fund the horn through Christmas and into 2015. He says, I'm not rich. I live fortnight to fortnight, and I've already chipped in $150 this month. So come on, check down the back of the couch and see what you can do. As usual, don't put yourself in hardship to contribute. Do it only if you can. Pirate says, Bob does his bit. Time for y'all to do yours. Wow. Teach a man a little bit of humility, a whole lot of humility, in a very few words. Thank you, Robert. Robert says, happy solstice. And this doesn't go anywhere without that kind of help. Thank you, one and all. Lines are open, 304-574-8178 or 304-663-HORN. 304-663-4676. Tim in the chat room, Tim from L.A., pointing out, you know it costs $3 million to fund KPFK, but $150 a night for the horn? Guess who's a better investment? Thank you, Tim. And again, thank you to Ron and Ralphs and Ryan and Carol and Thomas. Thank you all very much. Where now? Oh, we had a note in from, because you can't, I can't just squander moments of marvelous coherence. Had a note come in from Diane in Kansasstan. Diane noting, so Congress has gone after pensions? A pox on their house. On that subject, I meant to mention the other night that blank, blank Governor Brownback is going after the state's required pension contributions in Kansas in order to offset the deficit that's accrued thanks to his Alice in Wonderland Mad Hatter's Tea Party. Kansas already has one of the worst funded pension systems in the nation. The state was also recently sanctioned by the SEC for not accurately disclosing the shortfalls. And so it goes. The International Business Times, with the story, Kansas governor proposes using pension money to cover budget gaps created by his tax cuts. Hey, Sam, why don't you pray up some money, buddy? You're the big believer. David Sirota writing, in 2012, Kansas Governor Sam Brownback signed a landmark bill that delivered big tax cuts to high-income earners and businesses. Less than 2 years after that tax cut, the state's income tax revenues plummeted by $250 million. Nice. Thank you, Jeremy. Thank you very kindly for your help this evening. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob.
Hey, what's up?
Oh, not much. Thought I'd give you a little break from the BS that's going on in Washington, D.C.
Coffee break's over. Back on your heads,
yeah.
Right?
And who am I supposed to vote for now? Anyway, I fired up the smoker here last weekend, and I just heard you talking about fresh-caught walleye.
Oh.
I got a buddy that makes a couple of trips to Alaska every year, and he usually brings me back some good stuff. I smoked up some king salmon fillet and a halibut steak.
Oh, man. Oh, man.
Yeah, buddy.
Now, and that wasn't the whole fish. It was just, so how long did it take to smoke that?
I did it in about, it wasn't very long, 2.5 hours, 3 hours maybe.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it doesn't take very long to do fish.
No, not at all. What kind of wood did you use?
Well, I've got a charcoal smoker. I use Henry Ford's greatest contribution to society, Kingsford charcoal.
I think as far west as you are, you might be able, at some point in time, if you ask around or whatever, you might be able to get a little alder.
Yeah, most of that's on the other side of the divide.
Rats.
Yeah, it's out in the, I used to work at a cabinet shop, and we made several cabinet sets out of alder, and...
Well, it's my, I've never been able to use it because I can't get it back here either, but it's always been my understanding, Bill, that, that alder is the wood of choice for fish, especially in the Northwest.
Alder, and I've heard people say cedar too. I don't know about that, but.
Well, the cedar is for like planked fish. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah.
That's where you have like a plank of cedar and you plop the fish on it. And you put the plank over the coals, and you let
right.
the plank serve as a sort of conductor. Now you'll see that in a lot of highfalutin restaurants like we don't have in Beckley.
Well, I do this every year for Christmas gifts for folks, and I send them off to my brother and sister. So we'll see how it.
Oh,
I did a pork loin too. And cut that in half and sent half of that to my brother and half to my sister. So
oh,
we'll
very
see.
Nice.
My question is, have you ever heard of a rolled brisket?
Yes.
I have never seen it, never heard of it. I've got a brisket I'm going to smoke for a very good friend of mine and her husband. And the darn thing's too big for my grates on my smoker.
Oh.
So I got on YouTube the other day, and I was looking around on seeing how I could maybe trim it up, or, there's a lot of trimming to be done on it, but came across this Australian Butcher Meat Cutters Union thing about...
Isn't the internet wonderful?
It is. I'm not kidding you. And there was a guy from Scotland who did one, too. And apparently it's big... In like the British Isles and in Australia. I don't know. I'd never seen it, never heard of it. But I was thinking about trying that on the smoker here Saturday morning.
Oh, that would be some kind of nice.
Oh, I'm hoping so.
Especially if you can lay hands on some kind of hardwood chips. Now, I've become, I've read a lot about, charcoal over the years, because I'm a nerd, and they do charcoals now that you can get at your, Home Depot, Lowe's, etc., yada yada, that are basically made in charcoals that are made in a kiln from hardwood only. They're not cubes or briquettes or anything. There's no glues, no binders, none of that. And if you just start it in a chimney, one of those charcoal chimneys with some newspaper.
Yeah, got one.
It is magnificent, and it burns. I personally think it burns hotter than briquettes do.
Well, I don't know. I've always been a Kingsford person. I've been fiddling with the smoker for 20 years or so. I keep burning them out and buying a new one, and burning it out and buying a new one, but.
Is it the classic Weber kettle?
No, I can't afford one of them. It's a cheapy little Brinkman.
Oh, okay. Oh, I know. Okay, I know. Is it the little bullet-shaped guy?
No, it's a cylinder. It's actually, I got the newer model the last time I had to get one, and it's got where you can lift the cylinder off of the charcoal. You know, the old one had the charcoal, yet was down underneath the water pan and underneath both grates.
Right, that was my very first smoker, that kind, and it used to drive me crazy.
Well, Brinkman's got one now that you can fill your water pan, put the stuff on the lower rack, put the stuff on the upper rack, and if you need to add charcoal, it's got handles on it, you just pick the whole thing up off the base, and you add the charcoal and put the whole thing back on, which is really nice.
Yeah, much more convenient. Because when I had my first one, you know, you basically had to take the whole damn affair apart to, you know, because you don't want to put just charcoal in, you know, and take the whole thing apart, get it hot again, put it all back together again, and then hope for the best.
Well, that's the problem. You lose so much heat. This you don't lose much heat at all because the lid stays on it. You know, everything's right. I mean, it doesn't take very long to dump a chimney full of unlit charcoal on that thing. And it works really good. I'm happy with it. I wish I could afford a Weber bullet, but.
Well, that's like me. I've got ambitions somewhere down the road based on things that I've been told. In fact, Horst and I were talking about the way that he said it's the best chicken he's ever eaten in his life anywhere on the planet, the way they do chicken in Taiwan. And I mentioned the big green egg. I don't know if you've ever seen those.
I've seen those, yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to just see what one of those little son of a guns does. Because I think they weigh like half a ton apiece or something. They're huge.
They look really stout. I mean, everything looks like it's overbuilt almost. I've never seen them in person. I just seen.
I remember seeing them in person down in Alabama one time, and you know they were $500, $600, $700, $800, and it's like, no, that is not.
Oh
happening.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if I'm going to spend that kind of money, I'm going to get one of them horizontal jobs where I can. You know, just open the lid and
yeah, or get somebody with a cutting torch to go to work on an old propane tank and scrub it out real good and put hinges on it and go to town.
You know what makes a real good barbecue pit?
What?
The interior tank of a water heater.
Oh, I'll bet. As long as it's metal.
Glass lined, and for barbecue, and you know, just pork steaks or chicken or whatever. But I made one of them, boy, back in the 90s. And that was got a piece of great material, this 1-inch flat bar, you know, that's well kind of got the spacing on it to use over culverts and drainage ditches and stuff. Got a chunk of that and cut it down to fit in there and put some fire brick in the bottom of it. It worked. Oh, man, it was great.
Oh, now see, yeah,
no
this
way
is,
you could it would rust out because of the glass lining on that tank.
Right,
you know,
this is manifestly unfair. I've got one of the cheapo horizontal, you know, offset firebox affairs, and the problem with it is that the little door to the firebox, that you know, there's no way to get a good seal on it, so you can never really really choke down the air the way you'd like to. So it's really, really hard to control the flame, you know, or not flame, but, you know, control the heat as much as you would prefer. So you
well,
tend to, yeah.
That's the same way this Brinkman is. The only way I can control the temperature on the thing, if it gets too hot, is to either open the little access door, which is on there for what, I don't know. I guess adding water to the water pan, something I can figure out. But, or take a little piece of wood or something and prop the lid open a little bit and let some of that heat out. But yeah, I'd like to be able to control the heat better, but 20 or 30 degrees for, you know, 15 or 20 minutes is not going to hurt anything.
No, it's when you multiply it by 10 or 12 hours that you start getting an unsalutary
effect. You got to keep an eye on them.
and you know what? Yeah, I love nothing better in the warm weather months. You set the smoker. You got the smoker.
Yeah.
You set your folding chair up. Next to the folding chair, away from the firebox, you've got your bucket with your ice cold beer in it. and you got your bucket of hickory chunks. And every once in a while, you just kind of leisurely lean over and toss in a chunk, close the door, grab a beer. Life is good. Hard to do that in 30 degrees.
Well, I've got an answer to that. I actually figured it out myself. I set my smoker up out behind my shed, and I use these pro thermometer, you know, the digital thermometer. It's got the little wire on it. You can magnet, yeah. And I set that up to where I can see it from the window of the monastery here. And every hour I just go to the window and look and see what the temperature is. If it's too hot, I run out and do what I need to do and run back in. But
yeah, but it takes away that leisure factor.
Oh, but I don't know, Montana up here, the wind just blows. You can almost set your clock by it. About 2 o'clock in the afternoon, some sort of a breeze will kick up. Sometimes it's just mild, and sometimes it's 30 miles an hour, you know, but you can almost set your clock by it. So I kind of try to do it early, and if I got to run through that, then that kind of knocks my temperature down for me.
So where did you come up with the halibut?
I beg your pardon?
Where did you come up with the halibut?
The same guy that went out to Alaska brought me back the halibut steak.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He's more of a salmon guy, but apparently, I don't know. I don't know exactly. He drives... I don't know if he drives vehicles or up or something. He's got some kind of business dealings where he has to drive up there. I think he runs vehicles, cars and stuff up to folks. I don't know. But a friend of his who's got a place, where is it? Anyway, he took him out on the boat, and they caught some halibut. I think he said it caught like a 60-pounder.
Whoa!
Well, they get big, Bob. They get huge. They get really huge. But, yeah.
No, that's what comes of growing up, you know, inland, you know.
Well, I've never been up there. I would love to go. If I ever won the lottery, I'd take that ferry that leaves out of Seattle. You know, drive on the ferry and then just let them take you up there. And because driving up there... Well, this friend of mine and his wife that I'm going to do the brisket for, they went up there last summer, and he drives a diesel pickup truck, four-wheel drive pickup truck, and they were hauling a camper, and diesel fuel is outrageous up there, apparently, and they were pretty much beat to a pulp by the time they got back. I said, man, you guys need to take that ferry, you know, and then... Bed and breakfasted a while, you know. But it's a hell of a drive.
Oh, I can't even begin to conceive of it.
Well, yeah, it's apparently it's a beautiful drive and everything like that, but
it will wear you plumb out.
You're gonna spend that kind of money on diesel fuel? Hell, a ticket on that ferry would be probably less. If not right at what you're spending on fuel.
So is it winter in earnest yet up there?
It was kind of faked us out here a week or so ago and got up to almost 60 for a couple of days in a row.
Because that weather map that I saw looked like it was pointing toward this big nasty mass, you know, over the Midwest, but you guys looked fairly clear.
Oh, it was really nice. In fact, I got the fish smoked on the last day of the nice weather, and it got up to almost 55 that day, and that was last Friday. But it changed when everybody was getting all that rain in California.
Yeah.
Here last week, well, that kind of pushed or left the door open for a cold front to come through, and it dropped off real quick, and it's more like winter time now, but January and February are the months that we really get it, at least that I noticed. I've been up here 20 years.
Well, I guess I'm looking at the map now for Tuesday, according to AccuWeather. It's showing right poor through poor travel conditions through Idaho and into Montana and down into Wyoming. But then everything from the Great Lakes down to Mobile Bay, west past New Orleans and all the way to the east coast of Georgia, is just a blob of stay home.
Well, it's supposed to start snowing on. That's why I've been checking the weather, because I want to get this thing done for Christmas for these folks. I've been checking the weather, and Saturday is supposed to be nice. Night, if consider 35 during the day, and maybe a few passing clouds. And then Sunday, there's a pretty good chance of some sort of precipitation, either rain or snow. And if it's rain, it's worse than snow as far as I'm concerned, because it freezes at night and it's just ridiculous.
Yeah, and it's and it goes all the way to the bone.
That's true. That's true. And actually, from then on through Christmas, we may get a white Christmas. I don't know. I mean, it can change. Being on the east side of the Continental Divide and the way the Helena Valley is laid out, you just never know. The only time it gets really bad cold is when we get what they call an inversion, where the cold air sticks to the ground, kind of sticks low and to the ground, and it is just bone-chilling, damp and nasty. But last week we got what they call a Chinook wind, which is a downsloping wind that blew all this inversion out, and it was gorgeous. And that happens two or three times a year in the wintertime. That's how you can see these girls out in the bikinis on the ski slopes.
Hello.
I've seen pictures. I've seen pictures. I haven't actually been. I'm not a skier. I'm way too old for that.
Yeah, I don't think my knees could take it.
The weather can change in a heartbeat, you know, so. Another thing, little bit of news from Missoula, Montana. Apparently there is still some sanity left in the country's court systems around, at least around here. Some guy in Missoula, his name is Marcus Karma, basically baited. He'd been having kids breaking into his garage or getting in his garage.
And wound up shooting, killing someone, right?
Shot a German foreign exchange student, killed him. And he got convicted of premeditated homicide because he baited him.
Well, I read a story about it. He actually had himself a sniping position set up for the kill shot.
Yep.
And the kill shot was the second shot.
Yep. He left the garage door open, partway full. It doesn't matter. He left the garage door open. And they put his wife's purse on the workbench. And the kid shouldn't have been out doing it, but he did it. And the guy shot him and killed him with a shotgun. And the jury just returned a verdict of guilty of premeditated murder.
And somehow or another, even in Montana, he didn't wind up being found to have stood his ground.
Well, Montana doesn't have stand your ground, but they do have the Castle Doctrine.
Right. Well, West Virginia has the Castle Doctrine.
Okay.
A man's home is his, right.
A man's home is his castle, right.
Which basically means there's no duty to retreat. But you can't set a trap just to go. Well, we also have laws in this state against hunting over baited fields.
Well,
and he was essentially laying a trap in hopes of getting to shoot somebody.
Exactly. And, I mean, the jury didn't take but a day or so to figure it out, you know what I mean?
I'm not sure it's bound to be appealed, and one wonders.
Well,
I hope the conviction stands.
That's the verdict.
Yeah.
You know, so. But. People are crazy.
Well, that, and of course, you've also got the new dress code rules to keep women from looking all trollopy out there in the state house, right?
Yeah, boy, I tell you. Trying to do away with the Montana tuxedo, blue jeans, and a bolo tie.
That's what it boils down to, right? So the upstanding, God-fearing, Bible-believing ladies can't be wearing that to no Montana legislature anymore, right?
Well, they got to watch their necklines and watch their hemlines. But apparently they've changed it now. I saw a thing in the paper that I didn't bother to read it, but apparently...
Do the men have to watch anything?
Well, of course, that's what they're watching. You know?
Oh, well, I walked right into that one now, didn't I?
Yeah, you did. No, I don't know, like I say, they've modified it now, and I didn't read the modifications. I don't, you know, excuse me, there's a few more important things than a damn dress code for adults in the state legislature, for Christ's sake. It only meets once every 2 years or something. Give me a break.
And lucky you are that that's the case.
Well, I don't know. That's how we got that thing I was called a while back about the changing the name of the state auditor. Remember?
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that happened in the last session of 2 years ago. That got put on the ballot way back then.
Just took a while to percolate.
Yeah, it did. And there was another... initiative of ending same-day voter registration, and that one I kind of investigated a little bit. And the guy that sponsored that bill 2 years ago, guess who he used to work for?
I can't wait.
Halliburton.
Why am I not surprised?
Why, can you spell Alec? That's what I was looking for. But it's real hard to get in the information on who's who and, you know, who's affiliated with them. Any current information, anyway, who are affiliated. But I wouldn't be a bit surprised that guy if that wasn't an Alec bill, because there's so many of them going around in different states, you know.
Exactly.
But anyway. Well, partner, it's getting to be kind of close. I was just curious if anybody heard of that rolled brisket. I'll let you know how it comes out.
Well, I'm curious to know, and just remember, if you ask a Texan, they'll tell you the very best part of it is what they call the burnt ends.
Yes, sir. But these two guys, they take that point in and they roll that rascal right up in the middle of the roast.
Wow. And then they tie it off with butcher's twine with those funny little surgical knots.
With butcher's twine, those real pretty and nice. Compact little bundle, and that's another thing I was wondering with the international audience that you have. Don't you have a guy from Australia?
Yes.
A couple people.
Yes.
And some people from England. I was just wondering if they.
Well, we'll probably get a check in from John or Robert or we've got a little handful of Australian listeners.
Yeah, I thought maybe I'd impose on. I mean, I know it's getting kind of up against crunch. I'll be listening tomorrow night to the Front Porch Crew, so we'll.
And who knows? The conversation may continue there. One never knows what's going to catch the fancy of the extraordinary ordinary roundtable.
I'm telling you, that is one of the best. I love that. That is, and Carol, boy, is there a Mr. Carol? Because boy, it wouldn't take much for me to be her stalker.
I'm praying to God she's going to take that as a compliment.
Please, I mean it in the most loving way possible, Carol.
Well, that's the way it is with stalkers. They really do mean it.
Anyway, that's
one of my favorite things about what we do here. The people who make up this entire community, every one of them has their own little fan base. And it's kind of a beautiful thing because I get to just sit back and watch it all unfold.
Well, I'll tell you what, man, that's a ringside seat I'd pay money for.
Well,
I was getting close to time to go, man. So
pretty nearly.
So
good luck with the rolled brisket. We may get a check in from points elsewhere, and you may wind up with more information than you ever thought you didn't want to know.
Can't have too much information, Bob. Can't have it.
Well, at least not where rolled briskets are concerned.
Thank you, Jesus.
Amen. Praise God.
Okay, man.
Later, Bill. Bye now.
Yep, bye.
That's our buddy Bill calling from Helena. And here we are at the end of the program. Thank you all very kindly for responding to and meeting so admirably the front end of Robert's Up Over Down Under Double Down two-tiered challenge for this end of December. And just so you'll know, when Robert does a challenge like that, it actually costs him $191 Australian, because the Australian dollar has taken a hit relative to the American one. The Australian dollar is worth 78 cents American now. There was almost parity at one point. So, in anticipation of tomorrow, Robert says, shake out the couch and dig deep. And we'll get a little bit ahead. Hopefully. Tomorrow is Friday on the Front Porch, and I'm thrilled about that, because I think I look forward to Friday on the Front Porch more than you guys do. And just a reminder, Sparky will be putting up the bat signal, so if you've never participated, you might want to try it for a time. Folks love it. And we'll have a rousing, Jim Dandy good conversation. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, first of all, for the time, the finite, precious time out of your lives that you spend engaged in this conversation, in whatever manner in which you engage in it. Thank you for your financial support that makes this continue. I wish I was independently wealthy. I would never make the first fundraising request, you may be assured. Thank you, one and all, to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy, and moderators in the Horn chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan and Carol Baker. Thank you, John Fox, now in Newcastle, Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Everything that happens here goes through White Rose servers. And Ben has been carrying progressive radio on the Internet on his back, virtually alone, since 2002. Imagine that. Thanks also going out to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACACT, ACHEACT.org. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.